Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
McDonald's has introduced new premium espresso-based specialty coffee drinks, including creamy lattes, frothy cappuccinos, rich mochas, even iced lattes and iced mochas, all custom-made to order. McDonald's, I'm loving it.
The Riff's Phone-In Talk Show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome to the broadcast, people, and good evening to you. Although, if you are, I guess, in Europe, good morning, and if you are in Asia, good afternoon, or whatever. If you're somewhere in the United States, you all do the math. It's about, what next you're going to want your microphone on?
If you're anywhere in the United States, hey, how's it going?
Jalene Jordan is with me as well. Hi, Jalene.
Good morning. Hi.
You're eating your Necco wafers.
Yes, I love them.
A candy that goes back into the 1920s.
Oh, they're just delish. Yes, you know, and my vitamin water.
All right, well, she's going to be out of control, folks. Sugar and vitamins. Our friends at the Waking Up store that's closing down shop in their location in the Universal Mall, who sponsored us for so long.
Yes.
Yeah, I thought I'd still give them a shout out. There's two weeks from today, I guess this is Sunday, they're going to lower the gate at the Waking Up store in the Universal Mall, so they're giving 25% off on all their stuff as part of a moving sale. And so get out there.
Support them in their last 2 weeks, and they will be back. I know they will.
They will. You can go to, you can go to wakingupstore.com. And also on Saturday, April 21st, which is Earth Day, there's going to be an, or is that the 20th? Anyways, so this
21st, I think it is, Peter.
Yeah, it's going to be celebrated out at Oakland University in Rochester, and there's going to be an Earth Day Expo. And the Waking Up store people are at my kitchen, Denise Kitchen, are going to be out there with their stuff.
Good.
Well, I spoke to a friend of mine this evening, and she said, I am so sick of hearing about Don. Is it Don? Yeah, Don Imus.
Don Imus.
What did he say? I can't remember that phrase he used. Oh, yeah. You know, there's now nappy-headed hoe teddy bears.
For real. You told me.
Yeah.
So I do know. And who in the hell is making these things?
What's it all about? What is it all about? It's just all about money, isn't it?
Well, you know what? At least Don Imus didn't go directly to rehab. Come on, dude.
He could have,
like everyone else.
Nasty, mean man, racist, homophobic, misogynist, whatever, rehab. Now, listen, as an at-risk...
That's quite the rehab.
Right. As an at-risk talk show host, and Jalene fits into that category as well, his being fired by his parent company, CBS, does not strike me lightly. Jalene and I, as many of you know, did a nationally syndicated show, and there were all sorts of efforts locally to get us off affiliates. And in fact, we lost affiliates continually because we did things that were now pretty common, like calling Bush a liar, saying that Bush was a crook.
You know, criminal, all this, yeah, things
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, things that now that you hear on talk shows all the time. But this IMUS thing, I don't even know really how to approach it, and I don't even know if you want to. Oh, yeah, we got to give you the phone number. 313-298-WRIF. Don't reach for your phone real quickly, though. This is sort of an unusual thing to say for a talk program, but just make sure that you don't run into a buzzsaw, me, okay? Because let's kind of set the context for all of this, because, hey, hasn't there just been, you would think, almost everything possibly said about Don Imus and his remarks? But, hey, keep this by your side. 313-298-WRIF, like in Frank, which turns out, and I say that for you people that are in Asia and Europe and what have you. And 313-298-9743. Email at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. My website is Peter Werbe. Last name is W-E-R-B-E. PeterWerbe.com. Our MySpace space or page is myspace.com/nightcalldetroit. So it's just MySpace.
And it's ever-growing. I put photos in the slideshow.
Yeah, you do.
We have new friends. We have over 90 friends in 2 weeks. I mean...
You think that's a big deal? I mean, if people
have
4,000...
I do. Considering we've done zero promotion of it, except for maybe a couple of mentions here on the show, Peter.
I mean, who are these people? Like this 17-year-old woman in Scotland? I mean,
yes.
Why? I mean, she knows about this program or just kind of... Or who knows?
Who knows how they, I mean, people spend hours on this.
Wow.
And looking, you know, maybe she looked for, politics that makes sense.
From Detroit, yeah.
Right.
I'm in Scotland, but I want to know what Werbe and Jordan are saying in Detroit. Okay, hey, welcome. What's your name? Or she's from AYR, I think. A-Y-R? Is that how you say that? I think. We'll look at MySpace in a minute. But, all right. So let's just quickly get to the IMUS thing. One of the things I want to know about everyone who has expressed such great and intense response to this is, what is your dog in the fight? You know, that's an old expression. I mean, what's your interest in this whole thing? Now, my unnamed wife, who says, don't ever say my name on the air.
And you never have?
And a friend of, I don't think, and a friend of ours, both who said they had never heard the word IMUS before in their life.
Yeah, right. Well, okay. They probably don't watch TV or cable.
They don't watch TV or cable. IMUS was here in Detroit on a talk station, WXYT, before it went all sports, I don't know, 6-8 years ago,
okay.
Maybe. And he did terribly. I mean, he just didn't get any, as we say in the biz, any numbers. He didn't get ratings worth a damn, so they got rid of him. So, to me, the only way I ever heard of Don Imus was the complaints that media watchdog groups made about him all the time, his continual racist, homophobic, anti-Semitic, misogynist. And, I mean, he's typical of this phenomena where people say, oh, I'm an equal opportunity insulter. I make fun of everyone.
That's okay.
I'm politically incorrect. Well, you know who they don't make fun of? They don't make fun of white, the WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant men. Because
True.
Where are the jokes about them? Because that's who essentially they play to. They play to essentially sexually and economically anxious, insecure white men who feel that there's all these, that once that they have this mythologized sense of the world that once upon a time when a man was a man, essentially what they mean is that when a white man was a white man.
I thought you were going back to the hunters and the gatherers.
No, it wasn't. Well, yeah. But, I mean, it was. I mean, I shouldn't say it's mythologized in the sense that that white males didn't control the whole system, but rather that somehow all men who were white shared in the power. But once you start allowing everyone into a society that, because of the vast maldistribution of wealth, can't support everybody well, suddenly you have this greater pool of people competing for limited resources and jobs and wages and what have you. So if you start, I mean, because if you go back a generation, 30 years, and you turned on television for anything important, all the politicians were white men, a few exceptions. Everybody on television that made pronouncements, like commentators and newscasters, they were all white men.
Yeah.
Well, when you start,
so Barbara Walters came along.
Yeah, yeah. And then, but when you open up the pool to more people, because you say, hey, wait a minute, isn't this what the American Revolution was all about? Because, as we know, when the American Revolution was successful, the only people, not only was it like democracy, the process of voting, open only to white males, it was also only open to white male property owners. You had to own property in order to make, even to cast a ballot. So the history of essentially revolutions like the French Revolution, and the English and American revolutions was the broadening of who is inclusive. And it's always been extraordinarily hard. What women had to go through to get the vote, what African Americans had to do to get the vote.
Absolutely.
In the South, on and on. And still the residuals of resentment still remain there because, as I said, this extraordinary insecurity that the rulers always keep us in. And they essentially keep us fighting among ourselves over really stupid things like gender and race and stuff like that, when the real contest is always about class.
And you say stupid because these shouldn't be issues either.
No, because
we shouldn't be having these gender wars.
Right.
And
because what we should be involved in is what the rulers are always involved in, class war. I mean, because, you know, the Republicans, when you say to them, gee, I think we ought to raise the minimum wage up like a nickel, they say, you're involved in class war. Well, the rulers, and who, particularly the Republicans, very frequently the Democrats as well, but particularly the Republicans represent, are the ultra-wealthy elite. And they are practicing class war against the middle class and the working class all the time for their advantage. And they're almost always winning. Sometimes there's periods, like in the late 30s and into the 40s with the union movement, that a common everyday people had the ascendancy, both politically and culturally. In the 1960s, with the civil rights movement and the counterculture and all that, the rebels had the ascendancy for a while, but always, I mean, one of the ways that the rulers deal with stuff is they include parts of it. They say, okay, Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell, well, you know, we'll let you in.
Well,
and they'll let women
in. Which you represent.
Yeah, women into. All right, but let's get back.
So now, we need this to happen again.
Well,
the ascension.
Yeah. We need to. We need more rebels. But let's get back to Imus. First off, who is responsible for all this? Well, first off, even Imus admits that it was his remarks. Everybody else has said they're reprehensible and stupid and racist, and he has said that a number of times himself. And the other entity responsible for Don Imus's demise is certainly not black people, certainly not Al Sharpton or Jesse Jackson, but it's the CBS Corporation. Because
that's right.
Here's what I think that they had planned to do. That they, remember, they suspended him for 2 weeks, and then he was going to come back when? He was going to come back in the middle.
It was MSNBC who suspended for two weeks.
Yeah.
And then CBS fired.
Right. But the idea was that CBS was contemplating what to do.
Yeah.
And the idea was that they were going to kick him off for 2 weeks, and then think about the draw that this man would have. The two people who I mentioned, my wife and our friend, who had never heard of Imus, suddenly he is Imus. The only thing is, what ended it? I mean, people say, Al Sharpton got him fired. Al Sharpton has power over CBS in no one's dreams, even Al Sharpton.
I'll
tell you what fired, and I'm sure many of you know this, American Express, Sprint, Nextel, Staples, Procter & Gamble, and General Motors, Bigelow T. Bigelow T stayed. I must thank them. He all of a sudden wasn't going to generate $15 to $20 million worth of revenue for CBS. Yeah. So this is essentially what happened. And Let me see. I actually made a few notes here. I may have said everything.
There's so many levels to it. I mean, there are the women who, you know, are upset. You know, the Feminist Majority Foundation, of which I'm a member of, and Eleanor Smeal, who's the head of that, talking about, you know, the use of the word ho, for example. When these are women out there, athletes working their, you know, their butts off out there, and they're probably very good students. And
yeah, they were.
I mean, come on.
See, that's the real mistake he made. Of all of Imus's past mistakes of calling a black New York Times reporter a woman, the cleaning lady, of calling, here is the worst part about this all, that he felt no compunction. I mean, this surprised him, because he had made remarks of this nature endlessly for the last 30 years. And there was a sympathetic audience that sees that as humor. Of rather than attacking, as people have done historically over the centuries, making fun and ridicule of the people above us, that these people make fun of the people that are at least still a little step down on the social hierarchy, the social ladder.
Yeah. You know what I think is great is that I think that creating more dialogue is important. And, you know, sadly enough, it exists. We've had those remarks from Mel Gibson, Michael Richards, Isaiah Washington, which is the one from Grey's Anatomy. I don't know if you know about that one. Yeah.
Sure.
On and on, you know, these things just keep coming out. These mostly white men can't help themselves, except for Isaiah. But these men can't help themselves.
They have political Tourette's.
They have political Tourette's. They have racial Tourette's.
You know what?
They have homophobic Tourette's.
You know what? I think you famously made that phrase, uttered that phrase several years ago. These are the guys that blurt out the N-word or the C-word or something like that. But I don't think this is quite the same thing, because Imus felt that he could say this with impunity, that nothing would happen. But here's what he did. He attacked sports figures. And sports is one of the few racially, I mean, I know it's got a lot of racial aspects, but it's still one of the most racially free areas. This is where we see blacks and whites cooperating on basketball and football teams.
Financially, let's talk about that.
Yeah. And the people that he attacked, it wasn't Al Sharpton that he attacked. It was these wonderful, beautiful young women who were these students of with high grades, and they were these Cinderella girls who lost the first four of their seven games and almost won the NCAA.
Right.
And to think that some old, mean white man said nappy-headed hoes. I mean, and thought that that was funny, and B, that he could say it without consequence.
Right. I was absolutely astonished. I said, am I dreaming? Because oftentimes I sleep with the CNN on.
Okay. I thought you were going to make
it
some
woke
confession.
Me up.
No.
I said, what? No. Not tonight.
All right. Jill Nelson, who we've had on this broadcast, who's a journalist who is the author of a book called Straight No Chaser, How I Became a Grown-Up Black Woman, said the absence of the voices of African-American women in the current discussion of Don Imus's comments emphasizes how irrelevant, powerless, and objectified black women are to much of larger society.
Oh, wow.
In addition, those who seek to equate Imus's comments with hip-hop lyrics as if misogyny in hip-hop somehow makes what Imus said okay are acting as apologists for sexism, racism, and the corporate greed that is too often the American way. Yeah, I don't get that. I mean,
now this has moved on to Snoop Dogg.
Yeah, they're saying, Snoop Dogg says it, you know, I heard a hoe. That's like some vile white racist uses the N-word, and when you call them and you say, well, that's what they call each other.
Right, right.
Well, the they that I know would not be saying that, and I defy one of you people that use that crap of an argument to say that word in front of them and see the results. You wouldn't say, oh, well, you people. That's what Imus said, too. He said, well, people.
You people. Oh.
Yeah. Well, the other thing
there
he said.
There ever was a phrase.
How about this? He said, too. I mean, it's like the guy. Now, this is political Tourette's here. That, he said, and this didn't get any reporting. He said, when will Al Sharpton be apologizing to the Duke players? When will Al Sharpton be? I mean, in other words, this is black English of that with that B stuck in there for the dominant society inappropriately. And I'm thinking, what? I mean, how the hell did Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson ever get into this? You know, there is no black community.
There is no black community.
I mean, there are millions and millions, tens of millions of people of African origin and of mixed race in this country. But what's the community? What is it based on? Why are there, quote, black leaders? Who are the white leaders? George Bush? Noam Chomsky?
Howard Zinn?
Howard Zinn. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. In fact, the fact that people are identified as black leaders, and who identified them that? The media. Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson got into this, and they often say a lot of good things, and they often do a lot of good things. They often, they've had some problems in going off the deep end in some of their utterances as well.
Well, they're upset, okay.
Real political mistakes, unforgivable mistakes they've made in the past. But how did they get on television? They were selected by the media to represent this mythologized, is that word again, mythologized black community that is made up of tens of millions of people that are so totally diverse. I mean, all of us have some common characteristics. There is something of like Euro-Americans that have some common characteristics. Certainly a group that has historically been enslaved and segregated and still has, that they're still,
having to hear crap like this.
Yeah.
How about that?
There is a distinction there, but it's only one that is created artificially. There's some racketeers all over that want to maintain these categories that a lot of, I would say, wouldn't you say most young people have so gotten over?
I would hope so, and I think so.
It's Don Imus, 20th century man. So maybe it's good he got retired. I mean, I don't give a...
Don's got a lot of money. He's going to be fine.
Oh, gee, that's too bad. I wonder what the hell is going to happen. In the meantime, nothing else important happened. Just that Citibank laid off 17,000 workers.
That's all? Oh. Yeah,
the Pentagon extended tour of duty by 3 months for people. Carl Rove suddenly has years of missing emails. Gonzalez says it's a little hazy about the firing of these federal prosecutors. U.S. casualties in Iraq are up 20%. I'll save that. I was going to get into Iraq, but let's
we have plenty of time to do that.
Yeah, yeah. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Peter Werby here with you, Jalene Jordan with me and with you as well. And Joe, hi, it's Peter and Jalene from Brighton. Go ahead.
The whole thing about Don Imus, whatever. The only question I have is who won the game? You know? How come nobody talks about that?
Yeah,
I want to know, first of all, who won.
Rutgers lost.
Did they lose?
Yeah.
All right, well, that's a shame. Because I was going to say, if they won, they could have been like, what up? Don Imus, he doesn't mean shit.
But
can I say that?
Yeah, yeah.
But they were a team that was down at the beginning of the season and they what did you say they were
Cinderella
kind of a,
team? That's
Cinderella
what they were
team, kind of a swan song.
I went to Michigan State long ago and far away. I have to say the Jocks in a lot, many ways met the stereotype. They were meatheads. They were what my dad used to say, pieces of meat with two eyes, But these particular women from Rutgers, they were very, very, maybe that's not very nice to say about people, but a lot of times that as we all know, universities don't take people for their scholastic abilities, but they just want people that can play the sport.
Right. Rutgers is quite the university.
So these young women were really... they were exceptional. All right, let's go to Mike. Mike's in Howell. Mike, hi, you're on the air.
If we're going to talk about mythology, wouldn't you say that this white male power thing has somehow become a myth that's been purveyed that hasn't done a lot of us a lot of good in a lot of ways?
Well, most of us, yeah.
White male power is a myth? Is that?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not shared by all white males.
Yeah, that's for, like, most of us.
Yeah, for most of us.
You're talking about, like, a very small percentage of people who are in these positions that somehow, and if anyone's got the power, I mean, Don Imus is the one who got fired, and these black girls are, you know, riding high. So who's got the power there? I mean, isn't that kind of a pile of garbage or what?
Well, I don't quite see that. I mean, certainly these young women were so magnanimous. They said that they thought they didn't have any position on whether he should be discharged or not. They thought it was between him and his employer.
They forgave him.
And they said that the coach said that she thought anyone losing their job was an unfortunate thing. So, it's like I said, is the two entities responsible for Imus's demise are, as he says, him for making a, as he put it, a reprehensible remark, and his employer. Nobody, no a group of outsiders, which means anyone outside of the corporate world, has the power to pressure CBS to that extent. He was fired essentially because all the advertisers deserted him. All right, thanks, Mike. Appreciate it.
You know, Frank Rich in the New York Times said it's possible that the only people in this whole sorry story who are not hypocrites are the Rutgers teammates and their coach, C. Vivian Stringer.
Yeah. Well, I didn't exactly like that column by Frank Rich, who was on Imus's program continually. All these liberals.
Or has been.
Yeah.
I don't know if he's going back.
Well,
there's no show to go back to.
Yeah. All of these.
There will be on satellite, I bet.
I mean, one of the things that these media watch dog group said to all of these liberals is, how can you keep going on this show where this man is a good part of his humor? He had somebody on there that he described, I think it was his producer, that his function was to tell N-word jokes. I mean, that was Imus's remark.
For real?
Yeah. And he denied it on 60 Minutes, and then there was somebody that said, Don, I heard you say that. And he said, and then Imus said, well, it was taken out of context. I wasn't saying it publicly.
Oh, the old out of context.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. I was just saying the N-word when just all the good old white boys.
Racist were, rehab. Maybe we do
them.
Need it.
Yeah. Send them off. That's what I say. You know, his good old boys, all his corporate buddies and all that hung him out to dry. Too bad. Yeah, too bad.
Absolutely. Yeah. And his wife came to his rescue.
Did you
read anything about that?
Well, she seemed pretty decent in the whole...
Well, sure she's decent. She's coming to... Speak for yourself, Don.
But Deidre Imus said
leave the women alone.
That the young girls started getting... Or the young women, I guess we should say. The young women started getting hate mail.
But you know what the coach said? There were only like 3 hate mails and hundreds of supportive... Yeah. Mails, emails, snail mails, whatever it would be.
That's right. All right. Well, here is Mike in Cleveland, Ohio, which we used to call Detroit without the glitter.
Really?
Mike, are you here?
Yeah, how you doing?
Good, Mike. You're on the air.
How you guys doing?
And we're doing great.
Yeah, there's a little bit of disagreement there about how you say, you know, the only two people are responsible are Imus and the head company there. I think once Revenal Sharpton or Jesse Jackson do get into it, they do have the power to do just about anything they want.
Name me another time. You know, you've got this myth about these guys. They do not have any power. They represent an
embattled
community.
It's yak.
Yeah, once in a while, when there's some egregious crime, like committed by the New York City police, like gunning down some unarmed
gentleman before the night before his wedding.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah, they can bring to public attention. They can mobilize people of good conscience within a community, but they do not have a bit of power compared to $15 to $20 million, and when that got yanked by corporations,
that's when he got fired. Didn't have anything to do with Sharpton.
If you think that a corporation is going to say, "Oh, Jesse Jackson's mad at us," We better take our... you're dreaming. I mean, this is part of the white mythology that somehow that people who have the least power in the entire country, in fact, have the most power. It's absolutely nuts. All right, thanks a lot.
So
thanks
think
for
about that. Chew on that
yeah.
for a minute.
Looking out there.
The pictures.
The podcast.
The blogs.
The special features you just can't get.
Anywhere else.
Super f***ing cool.
Get them online at WRIF.com.
I shall lose yourself.
Or check us out at MySpace.com/WRIF.
Guaranteed to be extreme.
Because we can always use more friends, and we won't be naked.
Does anyone else smell Astroglide?
101.
WRIF.
People are sexy and clever, and they always say something funny right before a commercial break.
Yeah. Everything that rocks. You're listening to WRIF.com. WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. And joined by Jolene Jordan.
That's right.
313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Call talkyes at yahoo.com. It's email. And myspace.com, Night Call Detroit. I haven't even been looking at the email. But this, some of these comments give me, go back to that sense, what I was saying, Mike Kitchen wrote in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com from
the Waking Up Store.
The Waking Up Store, yeah, I've got about nine things on my mind. The Waking Up Store is saying thanks for the mention out there. You can go to wakingupstore.com if you don't know what I'm talking about. All right, so I was saying, remember at the beginning, what dog do you have in this fight? I mean, now, if you call up and you say, look, that makes me really nervous that a corporation has that kind of dominant control over the utterance of somebody, whether even if we, quote, think it's reprehensible, it's one thing. But I got to tell you, that is life in corporate broadcasting.
It sure is.
It's true for me and Jolene. And as I said, we are both at-risk broadcasters, and repeatedly people... In fact, in the past, have managed to get the plug pulled on us on national affiliates and people, I don't know, are they still trying every Sunday? Our program director doesn't even tell me anymore. He said, boy, you must have been hot last night, Pete. I got six complaints. I said, well, let me see them. I'll answer them nicely. And he said, forget about it. Yeah.
Well, there's always, you know what? There's always going to be complaints about the, any music that's played from someone who didn't like that band. It's just the way it is.
Yeah. Well, and when it's for opinions, but this is beyond opinions. I mean, you know, there are like campaigns to against the advertisers of right-wing talk show hosts, and that makes me very nervous.
Because you don't want that to
happen. Yeah, because, well, it's true, is that, for instance, most big corporations have what they call no Rush, no Howard policies. In other words, they don't interview, not, we just played an ad for the band Rush, but for Rush, they don't advertise like Chrysler.
The band Rush rocks.
Yeah, GM and all that. They will not advertise on the Rush Limbaugh show. They will not advertise when he was on commercial radio on the Howard Stern show. And I don't think many of them like advertise on the liberal network like Air America or Nova M. Same thing. So this is all very dicey, and nothing that I just say, oh, good, you know, Imus is a, you know, is a nasty old racist and good riddance. I mean, there's something in me that say, yeah, but also I'm, it's nothing that I say flippantly. But again, what is your interest in it other than, and I'm not talking to all of you, obviously, than resentment? Because that's what keeps coming up over and over again. People say, well, sure, I said what he said was reprehensible. But Jesse Jackson and Snoop Doggy and the Hoes and So it turns into more racism and more racist reactions on the part of people who resent. And this is what America is all about, the politics of resentment. They resent any power on the part of black people because we know that black people are always supposed to lose. Unless they're sports figures, and that I said earlier, that's one of the mistakes that I mismade, yeah.
You know, I think there are really a lot of white people out there who just cannot wrap their own heads around it, who can't understand how horrible these statements really are.
Yeah. They know that the official ideology of liberal tolerance for all people is what governs. And so they know you're not supposed to say things like that. But I think that's an excellent point. They don't understand the impact that that has. You know,
I think they think it's funny. I think some people think it's funny.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, Imus has been broadcasting. I mean, I have a sense of what to say on the air and what not to say. I think I know what entertains or the interests of the majority of our audience here. We're doing it long enough. And so does Imus. And so when Imus says his famous three-word little famous phrase now, he thinks that's going to resonate with people. They're going to go, ha, 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 ha. So instead of seeing these, I mean, I think he made a mistake this time. Instead of seeing these beautiful, courageous icons of American spirit, he sees just, this undifferentiated, black women. He's a repulsive character. All right, let's take some more calls. Here's Will in Clinton Township. Will, hi, it's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. You too.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I called in last week. I figured I'd call in and get my 2 cents this week, too.
Sure.
So, you know what? I am absolutely angry right now.
Okay.
Furious almost.
Why?
Because people who do say these kinds of things often don't get the punishment they deserve, and I missed it.
Yeah.
When other people say racist comments, are they taken off the air? Are they fired or something like that? No. And our newspaper writers who, you know, say racist comments or sexist comments or bosses and corporate heads that do this, are they fired? No.
Bill O'Reilly at one point said wetbacks. He's still working, isn't he?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, but it's what I said. The target was not just the target was sports figures, and that is so dear to everyone's heart. And when we see, I mean, everybody knows when we look at our Detroit Pistons, we know that the majority of them are African American, but that's way submerged in comparison to the love that people have for the team and those individual players, even people that have in general bad racial attitudes, love that team and love the individuals. And You know, but so he really blew it. He really blew it badly. And the only people responsible, I'll say it once again, are Don Imus and CBS. Everyone else.
I think it's just Don Imus.
Yeah, well, yeah, ultimately it is. Because I got to tell you, there's any number of things that I or Jalene could say on the air, and we would be history. It's not a political, certainly not a any political opinion. Our bosses are very defensive of our right to say what we want. But there are certain words, I suppose, we could utter, and we'd be gone. And you could say, hey, wait a minute. Why can't Peter and Jalene say the F word or the S word?
We know better. After all these years,
we've
been so good.
Yeah. All right, Will, thanks for calling in. 313-298-WRIF, and let's see, let's go to Chris and Warren. Chris, hi, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you doing tonight?
Doing good.
You know what, it's fascinating me. Everybody's talking about Don Imus, but nobody's talking about Rosie O'Donnell.
About her? Bring it on.
Why should anybody talk about Rosie O'Donnell?
Well, she went public with 9/11 true for 9 minutes on The View a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, so what does that have to do with Don Imus?
Well, I'm just fascinated nobody's talking about that. There's
People are talking about it considerably, but it's apples and oranges. That's a political opinion. She believes, as does tens of millions of other people in this country, that that the official story of what happened on 9/11 isn't what happened. That, in fact, that the towers were brought down by controlled explosions, something that I don't happen to believe. But tens of millions of people happen to believe that.
Yeah.
And that is a political opinion that doesn't disparage anybody and isn't part of a whole history of disparaging remarks that acted to hundreds of years of awful social conditions for people just based on the color of their skin. So how in the hell can you compare what Rosie O'Donnell says as a protected political opinion as compared to some guy who admits to making reprehensible remarks about people that everyone knows that he shouldn't be made? He shouldn't have made that, right?
Well, I believe that, you know, everyone has a right to their First Amendment, you know, freedom of speech. You know, I don't really care for Don Imus, you know, but the thing with Rosie is they're calling for her to be fired. They're calling for her to be
Who is they? Who are they?
Bill O'Reilly, neocon media prostitutes.
Yeah, well, they go ahead. Have fun. It's not going to work.
Well, see, that is exactly. I don't understand why people listen to Bill O'Reilly unless you happen to agree with him. But I certainly would never call for him to be fired because of his political opinions. My hope is that people find his views so destructive.
Repulsive.
So destructive. So toxic to the body politic here that views like his, and this is my opinion, obviously, of what makes he's what is part of what's wrong and destructive in this country is that he would get no listeners, and that would mean then that people wouldn't listen to him. But I certainly wouldn't conspire to in any way or advocate that people like him and the rest of that right-wing crowd be discharged because of their political opinions. And that's what people are saying about Rosie O'Donnell. And that other thing, that other stupid thing that people keep bringing up about, well, on the rap records, they call him hoes. And so what are they saying? Don Imus is like a misogynist rap star? I don't get it. Or he's as bad as them? I mean, that's like the people that when you say something about Bush, they say, well, Clinton did it. And I'm saying, what are you saying? Bush is just like Clinton? All right, thank you very much. I appreciate your comment. 313-298-WRIF.
Yeah, Rosie, you love her or you don't. And
you know, it's media for one thing. I mean,
yeah.
So are we. I understand that, but I just don't get too exercised about what people say. Even these people. I mean, I get very exercised about George W. Bush, Dick Cheney,
right.
and the rest of these people that have driven this country, close to going down the drain on, you know, militarily and financially and all those other aspects that are key that affect people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
But and media is important. I'm not trying to say that. I mean, I've spent my whole life in it, and I've spent my whole life trying to affect people's opinions, but I don't know. No one's going to die from what I say or from what
that's true.
What Bill O'Reilly says. Man, what a piece of work he is.
I know.
Here's Fred in Detroit. Fred, it's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. Welcome to the broadcast.
Oh, hi, guys. It's me again.
Oh, wait. You know, we got a bad thing here. We can't bring you back. Wait, were you on today already? Were you on tonight?
Oh, no, but I call every week just about.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Go ahead, Fred. I'm sorry. I thought you were on tonight already once before.
Oh, no. We'll get used to the name.
Okay.
No, I was just calling because, I don't know, about four or five callers back, you had one that wanted to dispute the whole white male power thing.
Yeah?
He questioned that, and he mentioned how the girls from Rutgers are riding high. He seemed to have forgotten that Imus is a made man. He has his fortune. He's had his career.
Mm-hmm.
And these girls are probably as broke as I am. You know, they got a little bit of the limelight. They haven't signed any contracts. They haven't gone anywhere or done much yet.
They are eating dormitory food. That's right.
Right, you know. I hope much success for them. But, too, that also reminded me of something I heard from Drew and Mike the other day.
What's that?
Basically.
Wait a minute. Let me tell people across the country and around the world that Drew and Mike are the WRIF morning show here and are wildly popular, have some of the best ratings in the entire city and
in the country.
In the country. Yeah, go ahead.
They seem not to understand the very point that you made about Imus, what he said, versus other rappers.
Uh-huh.
You know, that whole music scene, it kind of is of the family and what you would say among each other in the family. You wouldn't put it out there in the street. And Don Imus is totally apart from that, like you've been saying. You know, now I'm black and I didn't take anything he really said, you know, as being, well, it was outrageous, but I knew he honestly thought he was being funny in that moment.
Yeah.
He didn't realize how stupid it was. So that's all, the only point I'm making.
Well, if I had all my brain cells, I could have responded to something you said, but I forgot what it was, Fred. Thank you. I'm losing my ability to multitask. Wait, you look frightened. I know who I am. 10987654321. All right, okay.
You're fine.
I'm okay.
I think you were concentrating so much on what he was saying.
I was, but there was some point in there that I actually lost track of. I've done that before. All right, this next caller is not showing up on my board here, so welcome to the broadcast. You're on the air, and who's this and where are you calling from? Hello, it's you.
Hello,
it's you. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Oh, this is Marion, and I'm calling from Dearborn.
Oh, hi, Marion. It didn't show up on my board here. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, and my point is, with the historical past of exploitation of black women and institutional racism, no white man should ever call any black woman out of her name, or any white woman for that matter.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
And I think Don Imus, I never could stand him. I tried watching him a couple of times, and I just had to turn him off. And I say it's no great loss. That's my opinion.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mary. I appreciate that. I have to say, I don't know that I've ever heard his show ever. So.
Well, I was actually kind of forced to when I was at a relative of mine's home. Let's put it that way.
Okay. We'll leave that.
Hell is that guy? He's horrible.
Here's Adam in Detroit. Adam, welcome to WRIF. You're on the air.
How you doing tonight?
Doing good.
Good. This is a good debate going on here. Well, conversation or whatever. But my comment is, and I'm not defending Imus or what he said. The guy's a total buffoon. And it really, he dug his own grave, basically. But now, I wrote a blog on this. Is that what I'm trying to? I think we live in a overly sensitive society right now, as we speak. And I grew up in the '80s or late '70s, early '80s, and shows like The Jeffersons, Sanford and Son, and of course All in the Family. I mean, the content of that show, those characters, George Jefferson and Archie Bunker, they made fun of everybody. You know. white people, black people, Jews. And what Ayman said was, it was completely wrong. But on the flip side, it's like Chris Rock could do stand up and say that about black people and there's no problem. People laugh, most likely.
Well,
it's comedy, though, right?
That's what
comedy.
My point is, and I'm not defending him, but he's saying the show is it's a comedy-based show. He's not funny, but he's saying his show is about humor.
Well, that's
what... right. That's what his defense was.
But Fred from Detroit, who spoke just a couple of callers ago, said, it's one thing when, quote, they, close quote, say it's another thing when people outside of that group, that people that have used it historically, oftentimes, you got to remember, the N-word, for instance, was the last thing that many black men heard before they were lynched. And so that's a word with incredible power. And the fact that the way it's utilized within the black community or among some, the African American people that I know, they don't use that word. You know, that's not it's not in their lexicon. They don't refer to one another, and it's because they're middle class. I mean, there's a whole. That's why
I hear more white guys, young white guys, calling each other that, and
still?
It just and it annoys the hell out of
what
me.
What is with these guys?
It's ridiculous.
You know, you don't have one of the things that we say in our group of friends is to a lot of times when people say things, one of our little sayings is you don't have to say everything you think.
And
you
know, it's so true.
I don't feel obligated to say things that could potentially be hurtful to people. I have so many things I'd like to talk about, can talk about, and the same is true with everyone else. And I have a vocabulary large enough that I don't risk, for instance, offending people. Why would I even want to do that? Why would I even want to have a show? I mean, obviously that these so-called shock jocks do it because they know they can attract an audience. And they're they're kind of naughty. You know?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, because, as I said earlier, the official ideology of tolerance, still, everyone isn't ready for that. Everyone isn't ready to hold hands, to be brothers and sisters, to be part of a unified country that faces all the problems. So instead, look at, only Jalene can see the spread of articles that I have across our console here that have to do with the environment, that have to do with the economy, that have to do with the war in Iraq, that have to do with 100 other, well, not 100, but 6 other things.
Many.
And instead, we're going to be talking about this moron who made these offensive remarks.
And we knew we would be.
Yeah, I guess we did. So why
reluctantly, but here we are.
Why did we bother to print all this out then? Why did we kill all these trees for this?
Because we have a whole other hour left.
Yeah, that's right. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. And the beat goes on. Here's Jason in Sterling Heights. Go ahead, Jason. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? Peter and Jolene, I love the guys' show. I listen to it every Sunday night.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, I just wanted to say about this whole Dine Ines thing. I totally agree with your last, like, 5 callers. First, the guy that said it don't really matter whatever people say on the air. Second, the person that said no big loss, because who listens to Don Ines anyway? And third, the last guy that said the oversensitive society kind of almost made me lose what I was thinking about. But have you ever met a Don Ines fan before this whole thing happened?
Yes.
Really?
I have one in my family.
Well, not in this city, though.
No, he's not in this city.
Yeah, who?
And he's in bed, and he's my dad.
He struck out in Detroit when Ines had his syndicated show here, I said earlier, 6, 7, 8 years ago, and nobody wanted to hear him here.
Well, can I ask you guys one thing, though, about
sure.
those other, all the trees you killed for all the other topics?
Yeah.
This may just be one guy saying it, but talk about those. Screw this guy.
Okay, good. Thank you very much. I'm certainly going to bring up some of them after the top of the hour. And, in fact, let me see. All right, we're going to get one more call before we do that, but please don't go away.
We do like to talk about what people want to talk about, though. And
yeah.
You know, if we're on a roll, we're going to go on a roll.
Right. Here's Maurice in Redford. Hi, Maurice. You're on the air.
Yeah. To what Fred said, I'm a black guy. And I don't think it's excusable. I mean, like you said, I think it's a socioeconomic thing as far as using the N-word and all the derogatory remarks. But I can't think there's a really interesting book about hip-hop culture and how it kind of inflates this. And I'm, you know, Don Imus, yeah, idiot. Like, only people who are, like, really old listen to him in the first place. So, I mean, you know, that's a not, and
I honestly say he had the, I mean, it may not have been funny. It was, I mean, it was completely tasteless.
Yeah.
But he still has the right to say it. I may not like it, but like I often tell it all the black people that I know, the way you tell the people who support him, hey, we're not going to support anything that you know, any of the advertisers, we're not going to buy anything that you're selling.
Hey, I have a question. Would it be different, maybe, if you were a black woman?
Well, actually, I discuss this with a lot of the black women that I work with.
Because
I work rare for a black-owned company. And they were offended, but then I we got into this debate, and we kind of came to the same conclusion. I said, you know, he's an idiot. It's already established for me, personally, I explained to them, it was already established to me that he was a racist prior to this event.
Sure.
He just kind of slipped up and said something out loud that he shouldn't have said.
Yeah, but you know what? One of the things, as a Euro-American whose ancestors come from Europe, this gives credence to the suspicion that many people of African ancestry have, that all white people harbor these kind of feelings, and that just given a little bit of the chance, having to blurt it out, I don't know.
You know what, Peter? Neither you or I would ever, ever even think about saying something like that. Never.
Well, it was so off the mark that, it was like? It was like 30 or years ago or more when, what was his name? Howard Cosell, who was this friend of Muhammad Ali.
He liked to dress up in women's clothing and get...
He did?
Yeah.
Well, that was not... And he was looking at this, some quarterback running or something like that, and he said, look at that monkey run.
And I'm thinking, and then Jimmy the Greek made the comment.
A lot of people have gone down for that. Hey, you know what we got to do? We got to get these commercials in before midnight here in the Motor City. So thank you so much, Maurice. Appreciate your input. 313-298-WRIM.
This is WRIM.com.
Back
with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and welcome back. 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Jalene Jordan is with me.
I am.
Who operates MySpace.com, Night Call Detroit. You can become our friend, whatever
you want. Yeah. You know, most emails I would encourage you to continue to send to calltalkyes@yahoo.com because I'm really having some problems.
So you can email us at MySpace?
No, I think people should email you.
Yeah.
And you can email us at MySpace, and I will read them once I have my computer all set up here. You know, we just have things to do.
That's right.
Yeah. We're right, we're always a work in progress.
Let's see. At,
keep it fresh, Peter.
At 1 a.m. Eastern time, we're going to be running some interview. Peter Phillips, author of Censored 2007, the top 25 censored stories. I know this is going to shock you, but the MSM, the mainstream media, is not reporting all the news that we need to know in order to make informed decisions. And also, Joseph Gerson, who is the author of Empire and the Bomb, How the U.S. Uses Nuclear Weapons to Dominate the World. Oh, I hate when that happens.
But then again, we knew that.
Yes. If you go to my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerby.com, go to the calendar. It's a little skyline shot of Detroit on the left side and all the events that are coming up, including, and I would highly recommend this, Barbara Ehrenreich, who wrote the book Nickel and Dime, Not Getting By in America. And she's going to speak about her brand new book. Man, I finished it. I just love it. It's called Dancing in the Streets. I've promised it to Jalene. A History of Collective Joy. And it talks about how we, throughout history, we've always tried to come together in these public festivals and rituals to obtain these ecstatic states.
Yes.
And they originally were religious, but not in the sense, not of formal religions like the ones that exist now, but really to both integrate the people involved so that they were...
Spiritual dancing, maybe fire, things like that.
Masks, masking, that was great. Music, dance, and masking. And you know that that all, at different times during the Middle Ages, hundreds and hundreds of years apart, when the church tried to stop these huge festivals, they kept denouncing cross-dressing because that was one of the parts of the festivals. Men would dress up like women and women would dress up like men. I mean, this is like 1300.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this goes on now. I have a lot of friends who do this.
Well, whatever. But there, it was accepted as a...
I love them all.
Well, it was part of the community where these would be festivals like Carnival or Mardi Gras, where and people would also dress up and to ridicule again this the ridicule that goes up. So the common people would ridicule the lords and the king and the pope.
Ooh.
And they weren't looked upon very sympathetically by the people in power. So there is essentially this 2,000-year effort to suppress collective expressions of joy.
And I think it continues.
Yeah. Well, there's some things that still go on. Oh, in the book, I forgot to tell you about this.
Okay.
They Barbara Ehrenreich, the author of Dancing in the Streets, she mentions as examples, like, for instance, the Burning Man Festival in Nevada, but she also mentions the Women's Music Festival in Michigan that you go to every year.
This will be my 10th year.
Wow.
Yeah, of going. And Burning Man, you know, they come kind of close to each other, so it's been tough to meet, for me to get to Burning Man.
Have you been there?
I have not, but I will.
Anything out in the desert in the summer.
You have to bring everything in with you in this one.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? I didn't even get to my point that Barbara Ehrenreich's going to be in the Detroit area Wednesday, April 18th, and she's going to be speaking for free at the Central Library in Grosse Pointe. So,
and we're working on getting an interview. Little time with her.
Yeah.
She's a toughie, I tell you. She's desired by a lot of news organizations.
Yeah, so maybe when she's in town, I'll get an interview with her, get her into the studio. But I actually have the book, Dancing in the Streets, A History of Collective Joy, on the front page of my website saying a must read. And I would say to people, if someone said, well, give me a couple books that will explain to me, your core beliefs, meaning me, I would now give them that book. I am so impressed.
That's powerful.
With this book. So I mean, it's Dancing in the Street, and Dancing in the Streets comes from...
Van Halen, you mean? Or
oh,
what?
Man, you are such a rocker.
Well, I thought you were talking about our playlist.
No,
clarify.
The Van Halen song comes from Martha and the Vandellas, the Motown song.
Oh, is that what you're...
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Okay.
And
I actually do have a quite extensive knowledge of
I know,
music.
You do. More than me.
Oh, I don't know.
No,
about
you
that.
Do. Anyway, let's not talk about this. But Martha the Vandellas was a Motown group, and it was fronted by Martha Reeves.
Yes.
Martha Reeves, besides belonging to the same union that I do,
right.
She still lives here in Detroit, and she's on the Detroit Council.
City Council.
Yeah.
She is.
Yeah. She's wonderful. She has sung at peace events and what have you. So she's
wonderful. Great.
She's one of my faves. Whoa.
And Martha, we give you the credit, okay, babe?
Well, something just happened that I no longer have the little thingy up there that tells me, I don't even
phone know. Calls? Or
yeah, that little program is went south on it. Oh, here it
there
is.
There it is.
Huh.
It came back.
Oh, you saw it over there.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Let me just.
It's quite the studio, people.
Yeah.
Let us tell you, there are many, many screens.
Many screens.
Much to keep track of.
Now,
sometimes too much.
You know what I don't get? Let's go to one of these. If you want to talk about Don Imus, stay on the line, and if you want to call in, 313-298-WRIF. But do you ever the United States troops are dying at this increased rate? I assume Iraqis are dying also at this increased rate. And do you ever think about this? Who is the United States fighting? Or maybe the United States troops are fighting everybody. Because now the Shiites have called for the U.S. to leave Iraq. Tens of thousands of Shiites, a sea of women in black abayas and men waving Iraqi flags, rallied this last Monday to demand that the U.S. forces leave their country. Some ripped apart American flags and tromped across a Stars and Stripes rug. Now, most of the focus we have is on losses of the people from our country. And it's up to almost 3,300 now with a couple, I don't know, probably up to 30,000 wounded, some of them just terribly, as we've seen lately. And so the Shiites, now that we always talk that the insurgents were the Sunnis, right? Well, this is the Shiites, tens of thousands of them marching.
This is a huge protest.
Yeah. Iraqi soldiers in uniform joined the crowd of marchers, which stretched for at least 3 miles and was led by a dozen turbaned clerics, a Sunni Muslim among them. Many marchers, especially youngsters, danced as they moved through the streets littered with balloons. This goes back to the public festivals
and
that I was talking about.
Chanting death to America.
Death to America. So what, the few of you who remain, and remember there was somebody called in and said that
they're happy.
Yeah, their friend were glad to see the United States troops. Well,
we brought them that candy to the kids.
Right. Well, the Sunnis don't want us in Iraq. The Shiites don't want us in Iraq. The American people don't want us in Iraq. So why the hell are
we
allowing
people, right?
Yeah. Why the American people. We voted last November
to stop this damn war. Okay, yeah.
And George Bush just continues it, and the Democrats are just not, giving the kind of, leadership.
And it's just not a surprise. It's just not surprising.
And in terms of us, the Iraqi people welcoming soldiers into their villages and what have you, I tell you, if I was an unarmed man or woman or child and these foreigners came in armed to the teeth, I sure would be smiling at them.
Where's the candy?
Yeah, here. Civilian claims on U.S. suggest the toll of war. In February 2006, nervous American soldiers in Tikrit killed an Iraqi fisherman on the Tigris River after he leaned over to switch off his engine. A year earlier, a civilian filling his car and an Iraqi army officer directing traffic were shot by American soldiers in a passing convoy in Balad for no apparent reason. And it goes on to talk about these thousands of cases of which the United States military has paid reparations to... later, it says, the incidents are among many thousands of claims submitted to the Army by Iraqi and Afghan citizens, civilians, rather, seeking payment for non-combatant killings, injuries, or property damage American forces have inflicted on them or their relatives. Now, usually, with very, very few exceptions, and you'll have to do the math on this, the most that the United States will give for when they've killed a civilian relative in error is $2,000. The total so far that we've paid out is $32 million.
Can you believe that?
Do you know how many dead Iraqis that did nothing and that aren't welcoming us there that we have to get out and should get out yesterday?
And is that okay with you still?
Yeah, Jesus. I don't think there's a lot of people. All right, let's talk to John in Farmington Hills. John, hi, it's Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on WRIF. You're with us as well. Go ahead. Hey, John.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. I wanted to actually talk to you about the thing that, what do you think about what Rosie said on
the view?
Because I think it's great what she said, but, you know, is she going to get fired? Have you heard, is she going off the air? Because I heard she did it, but I didn't hear the after effects.
No, I don't, she's not going to get fired. I think,
nope.
Did she say that she was going to stop talking about that or something, Jalene?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think she's backing down from anything.
Yeah, because, listen, it doesn't matter how controversial you are. You can be,
yeah, you can be highly controversial,
yeah.
but not racist.
Yeah, think of these right-wingers. In fact, these right-wingers who say the most extraordinary things all the time. And, of course, no one even challenges them except for a few maybe liberal media watchdog groups. But saying controversial things often can translate into success.
The ratings on the show since Rosie has come on have skyrocketed.
Have they?
Yeah.
All right, so I guess Rosie's safe. All right, thanks a lot. I mean, unless corporate advertising is withdrawn the way the corporations withdrew it from the Imus show,
that's
what sunk him.
Yeah.
His stupid mouth and corporate decisions. That's the only thing that did it.
Right, but she does her homework, you know, other than, you know, not to get into a big The View conversation, but Elizabeth Hasselbeck, for anyone who watches her, she's this young right-wing fanatic who watches Fox News, and I just want to punch my television set every day when I see her.
Here's Stella in Hamtramck. Stella, hi.
Hi, good morning to you both.
Hi.
I also hate Elizabeth.
Oh, thank you.
Bitsy, we call her. Oh,
you don't want it. Well, wait, I can say the B word, can't I? I call her Elizabeth Hasselbitch.
Oh, that's good.
Hey, does...
sorry to offend anyone.
Does Rosie take her on?
Oh, yes.
Yes, she does.
Big time.
And so does Joy. Joy can't stand her either.
Right.
But,
we
you
like
know...
That.
I've seen the anus in the morning show, and it was just, he's just such a blowhard that, you know, I just turned the channel, but I think he has the right to say what he said, and I think, you know, if he called these girls a hoe, they could sue him because they're not prostitutes. It's slander, isn't it?
Well, they're so much above that and so much above him.
But and so much use of that word. I'll
tell you, Stella, you're the second person today that said he has the right to say it. But, you know, when you talk about the right to say things, that's a constitutional guarantee. That means that you have the right to public speech, particularly to criticize the government politically. But I could walk in tomorrow and my boss could say, I don't like it that you criticized IMUS, or I don't like it that you said that the United States should get out of Iraq. You're fired. And there would be absolutely no recourse whatsoever. So I don't have the right. I don't have the right to say this. I actually have the privilege granted to me, as does Jalene, by our employers, and we sit here and speak at their sufferance.
But it's the people that buy the products that tell Imus whether or not he can say something, not the government. I don't want the government to control us.
Well, yeah, but the government didn't. The government didn't do anything about
it. Right, exactly, and that's the beauty of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in terms of boycotts, I didn't know who any of his what do you call it sponsors were. So, yeah. I mean, I was buying proper Procter & Gamble products. I don't know that I would have bothered to. I mean, when I hear these sponsors on right-wing shows, I think they've really made a political choice to
be
do
there.
That.
Yeah.
All right, Stella, thank you very much. What we ought to do. All right. Let's hear Ed from Holland, Ohio. Ed, before we go, our last caller was Stella from Hamtramck.
Yeah.
How do you spell Hamtramck?
Oh.
Never
Why
mind.
Are you doing this
That's
to
That's not
him?
Fair because it has a lot of consonants in a row. Go ahead. Sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Hey, you remember back about 30-something years ago, there was a movie called Blazing Saddles.
Yeah.
Great movie.
Yeah. One of my favorite movies.
Madeline Kahn.
I don't think they could make that movie today because it would offend too many people. And, I mean, they made fun of everybody, not just,
But
you
if
know,
it's satire, I think they could. I mean,
yeah,
there,
I mean,
there is a lot
hear,
of satire out there.
Every time I hear April in Paris, I think of Cleavon Little riding through the desert with that Gucci saddle, you know. And I don't like Imus. To me, he seemed like he was hungover all the time.
Yeah.
Even though sober for, what, 13 years?
Yeah. And I, you know, it's like Rosie. I think Rosie will be next because she's starting to ruffle a few feathers by saying her Iraq, you know, making her views about, 9/11. And, you know, I'm not saying I disagree with her necessarily on that. I don't like Rosie. But I think she's going to be next.
Well, as I was saying, as I've said it several times, it has to do with ratings and sponsors. That's what it's all about. And constitutional guarantees to free speech just aren't even relevant here at all. Unless you have a contract, and even most contracts in radio have lots of easy outs for the employer, you're simply there for what you provide to them. It's like any business. I mean, once you pass the threshold of your employer, you can kiss the Constitution goodbye, right? I mean, you don't have the right. Like if you all of a sudden you say you have the right to freedom of assembly, and if all of a sudden in the middle of your shop or the middle of your office you say, "All right, I want to have a political rally here," you know, you're going to be out the door. All right. Thanks a lot, Ed. Thanks for calling in from Ohio. Let's see. Where are we going here? Here's Kyle in Ypsilanti. Kyle, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Pete?
I should ask people how to spell Ypsilanti, right?
Yeah, really?
You know who Ypsilanti was?
I do not.
What does it sound like by the name?
Not sure.
Okay, sorry, I don't mean to put you on this. He was a Greek general. Go ahead. Most people think it's an Indian name, but actually it's a Greek general. Go ahead. Sorry, Kyle. I don't know why I get off on these things.
All right. I just wanted to make a couple comments on the whole Imus thing. I'm sure you're getting sick of it, but you know, got to say my piece here. Number one, you did call him a repulsive character a little while ago.
Uh-huh.
Name calling.
Well, here's the thing. I have listened to his show a couple times, and on his show he does come across as a bit of a, let's just say phallus.
He's kind of cranky. He's a little cranky.
Yeah.
Did you say phallus?
Yeah.
Okay.
But look at what that man has done for children with cancer. Look at how much money he has raised for those kids.
Well,
everything that he does.
Well, what does that tell us? I mean, so we should... You know, again, it's not like that he was either judged by public opinion or anything else. His corporate sponsors, his employers, decided that he was more of a negative than he was a positive. No matter how much money he's raised for kids, or
and
what
I
kind
hope
of...
he continues to raise more money for kids.
Yeah,
hey,
sure.
That's a good thing.
Well,
he has redeeming qualities. Wonderful.
Number one, it's kind of hard to it's going to be a little more difficult for him to do that without the that platform of radio and TV.
Well, you know what,
the thing that really angers me, honestly, is that CBS, as stupid as what he said was. I mean, that was a stupid thing to say. But number one, it's okay for anybody in this country to be a racist as long as they're not white. It's a racial double standard. That irritates me. And number two,
wait, I don't understand that. You know, there are people of color. I mean, which is a swath of different colored people that have racialist views and even prejudicial views. But nothing, nothing like the white population, and there's very little harm. There's very little harm that come to white people from any Hispanic American or African American or Asian American prejudice towards them. But that's the whole thing. They don't like us and we don't like them. Well, there's always been, different groups throughout all over the world and in this country, Italians didn't like Jews in New York and Poles didn't like Russians here in Detroit and stuff like that. But when you have a history of a people that have been done historically great damage and continue to still disproportionately occupy bottom rungs of the economic scale because of discrimination and racism, it's part of a whole system. And not just attitudes or prejudice. Prejudice is stupid. And the more prejudiced you are, the less able you are to conceive of what real problems are, no matter what side of the line that you're on. But if racism is a system of discrimination, and there's very, very, very little ways in which people of color can discriminate against the dominant group. All right. Thank you very much. I mean, that's another one of these cop-outs, Oh, well, they say this and we say, they say the N-word themselves, They call each other hoes. And
they call us crackers.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that doesn't offend me. Call me one. I don't know. Personally, I'm not offended by it.
Here's Nathan in Port Huron. Nathan, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
Yeah, I was texting with Drew and Mike earlier in the week, and they were talking about like how Oprah did her whole deal about the white person marches to the beat of a different drummer where you just can't find the rhythm. What about that? I mean, going back to the double standard, what if it was, if Imus was black and he was racist against, white, how would that play out? If it was a total double standard,
I don't understand your point in bringing this up. What's your conclusion to your point?
The conclusion that I'm drawing is, say Imus is a black man, and he was, say he degraded Michigan State hockey. How would that be any different?
Well, again, you're kind of missing who these people are. They're people of color who, again, have historically been greatly discriminated against and continue to be kept in large disproportionate amount from participating fully in the economic system. Racism is the first manner in which income is maldistributed in this country. And becomes at the farther down the ladder you go, more and more of a scramble for the crumbs that remain. And if you can assign negative characteristics to a group of people, that explains why they are in the situation that they are. It's their own fault. It's because of their character, their inherent characteristics, that they are so disproportionately at the bottom of the economic and social ladder. So, and that is part of the racist system. That is racism. That's the ideology of racism. To say you don't like somebody because they're Italian or black or Jewish or something like that, that's just stupid. That's just a stupid person talking. But when you start repeating that those kind of ideas that suggest that people have the responsibility for putting themselves in the situation that allows them to be discriminated against, that's the justification for keeping things pretty much as they are, with one group dominant and the other one subordinate. And I don't know what, if he would have been this and he would have been that. I don't understand even why there's the bit of defense. The man himself said he made reprehensible remarks. And if there would have been a black guy making remarks against white hockey players, it would have made no sense to anybody. What would he say? Look at those blonde-haired white boys hitting the puck. I mean, that's not it. The racist remarks are funny to racist ears. Because of, humor is a little difficult to explain. But why the hell, what does that mean? What does nappy-headed hoe mean? Why does that carry with it even the slightest suggestion of humor? I mean, why would he think that that would be funny to anybody? And why would he? I mean, why would he put that out as a joke? And why would probably a good portion of his article or his audience rather go?
yeah, I was just going to say that.
Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Scott in Westland. Scott, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. Well, I had two things to talk about. I wanted to talk a little bit about why nuclear power is not a solution to global warming. And also, I have like maybe one deep thought about Don Imus and the N-word.
We'll be the judge of that.
But okay. Well, last week I was watching 60 Minutes, and I know you had a good bit a couple of weeks ago with Helen Caldicott, you know, talking about this nuclear revival that they're having, that,
right.
You know, now that global warming, you know, has become fashionable, you know, among people, you know, it's, you know, oh, now they're trying to use it as a justification to bring back nuclear power. Now, the one point, and this is error by omission, so in all the stuff I've heard so far, the one scientific point that people seem to be overlooking, even if you could forget about nuclear waste for a moment, or, you know, how energy intensive the nuclear fuel cycle is, Helen Caldicott was talking about that, that basically nuclear fission, even if we had a fusion reactor, suddenly they perfected that. Basically, it's still exothermic. So it wouldn't be producing a lot of carbon dioxide the way that a coal plant would, or even a natural gas, you know, fired plant. But basically, a nuclear fission reaction is a very peculiar thing, you know. And so you're basically producing a lot of heat, introducing heat into the biosphere that under no circumstances would have been there before. So if you compare that to, say, if you had a photovoltaic area on your roof and you used it to run your air conditioner, okay, that's all energy that was in the biosphere in the first place, and you're maybe displacing, you know, some heat between your house and the air, or maybe the groundwater or something like that. But basically, a windmill, you know, or a solar, you know, panel is not exothermic. It doesn't introduce heat in there. So, you know,
right.
The carbon dioxide isn't the only issue. Now, getting to IMUS, and this is just my sort of one deep thought about that.
Give me the one deep thought quickly.
Okay, is it when a black person uses the N-word, you know, particularly to another black person, they use it in the spirit of profanity. So it's like the F-word, you know. They use it, you know, because...
We don't
always know what they mean.
And I don't want to be an authority on this, but from when I've been around, it hasn't always been a negative thing.
And you know? Maybe there are some
it's
of...
It's just what I see from a white girl looking on into another world.
There might be some of the they listening. They're probably listening. Say, let's listen to what these white people
are
saying about us. All right.
They're laughing at us.
All right. Thanks, Scott. Yeah. Any of the theys are welcome to call 313-298-WRIF. This is, you know, I'm not even sure I'm always understood, but I was talking about the way that racism is the first way that income is maldistributed in this country and in this economic system. And just give you an idea, Scott, who's listening in Stockholm, Sweden, wrote, and he said, let's see here, where did I just see this? Your Finnish listener in Turku, which I don't think we were corrected on the pronunciation, but your Finnish listener in Turku must be an early riser and is yet another time zone towards normal waking hours in comparison to yours truly. In other words, he's even... Finland's even farther away. We have listeners in Finland. But he's saying, a few words about myself. I'm an American from Ohio who emigrated to Sweden in 1983 because the Swedish woman I met in the U.S. took one look at Ronald Reagan's so-called morning in America and said yes to me and no to living in the U.S. He's a smart woman, eh? I was 29 when I left, in the almost quarter of a century since then. I have seen enough of both societies to feel qualified to comment on some of the issues raised in last Sunday's shows, which focused on economic matters. Most Americans, says Scott from Stockholm, just don't understand that rather than progressive politics being some dream that is a figment of a few liberals' imagination, hundreds of millions of us actually live in societies practicing some variant of it and have done so for decades. It's not just a dream, but a daily reality and elsewhere. Now, if we had a country that was like this, I suspect that most of these issues would just disappear. All right. Some points from Sunday's show. Minimum wage versus living wage. Sweden's standard is to pay a living wage, generally around $10 to $12 an hour for unskilled work.
Right.
All right. So we're number one. We're the wealthiest country in the world, and we're paying more than half or less than half.
Yeah.
But here, he says, even within this relatively low wage, as he calls it, there's full coverage health insurance. Let's see.
When you have a baby, you get a year off.
Yeah. There are the cap on pharmaceutical costs that you pay. You might wind up paying $200 a year out of pocket. Public transportation is available even in rural areas and is much cheaper than driving. Child daycare is based on family income with a cap. Daycare workers are trained, group size reasonable. There's an annual child allowance for clothing, school, and supplies. And I think there's even some of that in Canada. So this stuff about family values that the Republicans put forth is just a load of crap. Because they would never put that forth. You get 5 weeks paid vacation per year. University tuition is free.
It's like being Arthur P.
That's our afternoon guy, folks. 5 weeks paid vacation per year. But he would go on strike if he only got 5 weeks.
No, yeah, I know. He gets more than that.
And I was talking about this last week. Why isn't university tuition free? It's because we're spending $500 billion a year on this war budget that's absolutely unneeded. The number of holidays, get this, is about 20 per year instead of America's 6 or 7. 1 year paid, about 75% of your income. Maternal leave to be shared by both parents. And just on and on. 80% of the workforce is union. Whereas here, I think in the private sector, it's about 8% now.
Yeah.
Accordingly, the difference between the highest paid, PAMP? What is PAMP? P-A-M-P? I don't know. And the end of the food chain flunky is a fraction of what it is in America. Labor gets a seat on corporate board of directors.
What do you bet we get a call that says,
that's communism.
Gotta go on over there anyway. Yeah. You don't like it over here.
And so what you get is here, Nicholas Kristof, who was in Mirwala, Pakistan, talking about the sex trafficking, because there's millions of women sold into sex slavery. And why? It all has to do with the income.
It starts at about age six, I think.
So the nexus of sex trafficking and police corruption is common in developing countries. The problem is typically not so much that laws are inadequate. It is that brothel owners buy the police and the courts. But Mrs. Parveen's, and this is this woman he was talking about, the tale arises not only from corruption, but also from poverty. Mrs. Parveen's mother, Akbari Begum, says, if I had money, this wouldn't be happening. It's all about money. In the police station, nobody listens to me. The police listen to those who sell the narcotics. And you get, remember, and this happened, this was weeks ago. Now, this woman in Taylor, Michigan, she was arraigned Sunday on charges that she offered to let an undercover investigator take pornographic photos of her 7-year-old daughter.
Remember? Oh, yes.
So why is she doing that? It's because of poverty. It's because of poverty.
And to have to go to those levels.
Yeah, yeah.
The levels.
Hey, we're going to be right back. Yeah. Peter and Jolene, 313-298-WRIF. Wait a minute. We've got some long-distance calls. Let's get that one out of the way first. Here's Andy in, it says here, Crooksville. Are you in a town called Crooksville?
Hello. Good evening.
Yes.
Good evening. Where are you?
Are you in Crooksville?
Cookville, as in Sam Cook.
Oh, Cookville. Okay. We were going to say, were you down there in Crawford?
Crookville. That's pretty. Yeah, that's another.
I don't think they named it after Sam Cook, but it's spelled like that. C-O-O-K-E, Cookville, Tennessee, where there is Tennessee Tech University, where I'm a teacher. But I'm a longtime listener to you online, and I miss you, Julene, from the old days. And so it's so great to have you back.
Oh, I really appreciate that. Thank you.
And I just have a couple random comments about things you were talking about.
Sure.
First of all, about free college tuition. Here in Tennessee, they're trying to give free college tuition for community college to everyone in the state. Now, you may not know this, but in Tennessee, they tried to give everyone free health care. They called it TennCare, and it was the Al Gore model system, and it failed miserably. It was bureaucratic. People were jacking the system, and they didn't. They were taking advantage of it and getting all kinds of, you know, high-end, health care
are taken care of, and people were bragging about 10 care, they'll let you do anything. And so we lost our 10 care because it was a system that wasn't working. They weren't paying for it. But the same governor now is turning around and wanting to give free college to everyone. And so we're just hoping he'll figure out a way to pay the teachers, because we don't have any unions here, no history of unions here in Tennessee like you do up there. But he says he's going to fund it on the backs of our smokers. We have one of the lowest tobacco taxes in the country, and he's going to try to raise tobacco taxes, and so hopefully fund that that way. But what about this weather? You haven't talked much about the weather tonight. Do you think global heating and cooling is having its effect? Because here in Tennessee, about 10 days ago, we had blooming trees. All the green trees were budding, and now they've all turned brown.
I think you know that that the global warming doesn't have to do with these variations that that occur in the weather, either large variations over decades, or certainly not when it's real cold here in Detroit. It was 82 and then it was down to 22. That's nothing about global warming. We're talking about, as you may know, a rise of like 2 degrees, which is sending all of this over the edge. And so, I mean, these right wing, why is this turned into like this political thing? Like there's this anti-Al Gore movie that has just been released, and it's all these right wingers. Al Gore isn't presenting this as a liberal or anything like that. You're talking about
as a scientist.
As a threat to the planet.
Yeah.
They hate him down here so much. It's so funny because you're from here, and he couldn't win Tennessee, and that's why we lost. They say we lost because of Florida, but we lost because we had a governor. A senator and a vice president from Tennessee who couldn't win his own state, and so. Tennessee is why we lost, but they can't stand him. When after he won the Emmy, they just went on a rampage around
here.
All right.
So, would you vote for Al Gore if he decided?
I don't believe in voting because I think it encourages them. But I do.
Are you a good anarchist? Is that what you're saying?
I do believe in voting as self-defense, and I think voting for the Democrats right now is self-defense against fascism. So, yeah, I think it's a matter of self-defense. But I like. I kind of have a soft spot for John Edwards from North Carolina, maybe because of his how open he is about his wife and her struggles, and how strongly he's into class consciousness and
universal
and changing
health care. He wants that
class consciousness. But I actually like DK. That would be Dennis Kucinich from Cleveland. I grew up in Cleveland before. I lived in Detroit, and Kucinich needs a new haircut, and he needs probably a new last name. But he's a great guy, and that speech he gave.
Let's not be shallow.
Yeah, no, he's a great speaker. He really believes in peace. He said that the resolution that got passed to put a timeline was way too weak, and he said if you're against this war, you need to vote for the troops to be out now.
Absolutely.
We don't want to take the troops out next week, not next year. I have students here at Tennessee Tech who are going to Iraq in the spring and in the summer and in the fall of next year, who are dropping out of school to go over to Iraq, and it breaks my heart to see these beautiful, young, bright kids. They're not haters. They don't hate anybody. They don't care about Islamofascism. They just believe in what they think the idea of the armed forces is, and they're ready to ship out to Iraq right now. And it just breaks my heart to know that these sweet young kids that I get to teach at the college level might come home in a box next year. So I just think we need to pull out right now, and I don't care if that means I'm weak. I'd rather be weak and alive than strong and dead.
Well, I think I think that's well said. Andy, thanks for calling in from Cookeville.
Have a great night, you guys, and welcome back again, Julene.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I thought Crookville, man. Yeah, wow.
Crookville.
Here, Jacob, who's listening in Oulu, Finland. You remember Scott from Stockholm?
Is it Oulu?
Yeah. He says, in Oulu, you come on rather late, 6 a.m. to 8 a.m. That's the prestigious hour. This is the morning drive, as they call it.
Hey, we're morning drive somewhere, Peter.
In Oulu, yeah. And he says he gets up at 4 a.m. to listen to Mike Malloy Tuesdays to Saturdays, so he gets to sleep in on Monday morning.
Right. Dedication.
Yes.
We love that.
Thank you, Jacob. And we'll be right back. 313-298-WRIF. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, and hold on.
This is WRIF.com.
Yeah, calling, but I can't hear you. I'm not laughing anymore. Yes, I'm sick of falling, but I can't save you. I don't see you anymore. You're calling, but I can't hear you. I'm not laughing anymore.
Now, Night Call is back. On 101 WRIF Detroit, here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Angeline Jordan joins me for our final segment. And remember, at 1 a.m. Eastern time, if you're in Finland or Stockholm or Seoul, Korea or Singapore or the South Pole, where we have a listener or listeners, you'll have to figure that out.
We need more listeners from France.
Yeah, where are they? You can also join as our friend at myspace.com, Night Call Detroit, as well. At 1 a.m., anyways, that's how I got started. And that Peter Phillips joins us for an interview about the top 25 censored stories of last year. Also, Joseph Kersen, Empire and the Bomb.
Whoa. And, you know, those stories, it's an interesting segment every time that you do that segment with Peter Phillips.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Really, the stories that a lot of stories that many people maybe have missed.
Yeah, well, that's the whole point. There was right. one. Let me see. What was there was one? Well, it's on the recording. I can't remember which one it was, but there was this Associated Press story that they sent out to 175 outlets, and something like three of them picked it up.
Right.
Are you getting cold?
Yeah.
That little noise was Jalene...
zipping up.
Zipping up. Yeah.
It's freezing in here.
Okay. Let's see. Here's somebody who's been waiting a long time. It's Mark in Brighton. Mark, it's Peter and Jalene. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter, Jalene. How you guys doing tonight?
Hi.
Hey, I just wanted to throw a quick thing out there about this whole Don Imus thing. I do not agree with what he said, nor do I agree with what Rosie O'Donnell said on The View. And if they fired him for speaking his opinion or being crass or just totally outright wrong, then why are Dominski and Doyle still on the air?
Well, let's not talk about people on other stations for openers, but you know,
in the same market,
anymore because I mean they're way out of line, and if you know, you may be comparing apples to oranges there, but if they're going to fire Imus for saying something like that, which was totally out of line, I agree with firing of that, then they should get rid of those people too because they do some outrageous, nutty stuff.
Well, let me.
Just, I haven't listened, Peter. To be honest,
yeah, I tell you, I hear him only. I only hear him very infrequently. But again, it has to do with ultimately with money. And if all those sponsors that withdrew their advertising from Imus would have stayed with him, they would have been CBS would have been so happy because his audience would have and probably the number of affiliates that he had and everything would have gone up.
But, hey, do you remember when that one morning show set it up, their New York show, set it up for the two people to have sex in St. Patrick's Cathedral and were fired?
Obi and Anthony.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't know we were mentioning names. But
okay.
Anyway, well, anyhow, you know, they're back on satellite, bigger than ever.
Sure. That works for them. God. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Let's see. Al's listening in Rochester, New York, and he says, I rarely disagree with you, Peter. I even more rarely agree with Rosie O'Donnell, but please read the book The New Pearl Harbor by Dr. David Ray Griffin or watch the film Loose Change, which is about 9/11.
Is this all conspiracy stuff?
Yeah, the truth about 9/11 is that we don't know the truth about 9/11. I agree with that, but I'll tell you, you ain't going to learn it by looking at Loose Change. I mean, that has got such a cockamamie premise to it, because essentially what it is, or at least part of it is, that missiles hit the Pentagon, at least the Pentagon, and it was a missile that hit the ground in Pennsylvania. Now, right. The way it's presented, you go like, whoa, this is pretty bizarre. But one of the things you have to ask yourself, if it was missiles, where are all the people that were on the planes that didn't hit the ground in Pennsylvania and didn't crash into the Pentagon? They landed in Cleveland. I mean, that's what it says in this...
I don't get into any of that.
Yeah, I don't think...
I won't even watch United Flight 93, the movie. I won't watch the Twin Towers. I won't do any of it.
Well...
I will not do any of it. Do you hear me?
Yes, yeah. This is... All right, this is from Anu. He writes, your show rocks and is so refreshing since all I get at night around here is a right-winger who I don't even want to mention. I do think the current weather weirdness is related to global warming, though. I have a really, really busy week, but I promise... Oh, yeah. Best of Jolene.
Yeah, where's Anu? I wonder where he's from. He is a friend on MySpace. I've seen Anu.
Yeah.
Anu. Or Anu? Anu? Anyway.
Well, I don't know.
Hi, Anu.
Hi, Anu. Yeah.
Thank you for listening.
Yes. All right. Let's see. Let's go to... Jack, I can't even begin to guess what it's... Oh, Romeo. Okay, I thought it said Rambo. Yeah, Jack's in Romeo.
There is another Rambo coming out, by the way.
The
Sylvester End It.
The
Sorry,
home of the...
That's another show.
Romeo's the home of the Octagon House.
You're good, Peter.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hello, how you doing?
Hi, Jack.
I hope another Rambo doesn't come out. I just got over that last Sylvester Stallone, Rocky 62.
it's coming back, God. Babe. I'm sorry.
Well, that's Hollywood.
Yeah.
But
what's up?
I was going to talk about Imus, but that's I want to ask Peter Werby and you, why are you getting so excited about the elections in 2008?
The same
people that are screwing us now are just running for a higher office.
Yeah.
That's the same people. So where do you expect, not you, I'm talking about everybody in America. I see my neighbors getting all excited. They're getting their straw hats out and their banners ready. And
you know why? You know why? My opinion is because we are so dreadfully sick of what we have been dealing with since how many years now?
Six
Too
and
many.
Seven and counting.
Okay.
But Jack, let me ask you this. Are people authentically excited, or are you watching television where the television tries to whoop it up as a big excitement? Because remember, some of these times when people, that all of it was about the election in 2000, 2004, and 2006, and not even 55% of the people even got out and voted.
Well, where's your change? Let me just say, the Democrats control the House right now. Gas prices are $3 a gallon, and they're going up again. The economy's shot. The war continues. The Democrats are talking about pullout in 2 years. When are the American people going to understand that Democrats and the Republicans are one and the same? It's like the auto companies. You get tired of a Ford, you buy a Chrysler. You get tired of a Chrysler, you buy a GM. Then you go back to Ford. The politicians already know you're going to come back to them. 5 years from now, we'll all be here. 10 years, we vote for all the Republicans again. It goes on forever. Never
no,
changes.
We're well, not voting for the Republicans again.
Well, I never did. Neither would I. But what he means is that there are, it's just kind of...
Same thing.
Yeah,
remember? Peter, you and I had a conversation about this the other night. Nothing ever changes. Did we not say it? Someone said that to you, or it was a song or something.
Yeah, well, it is a song. What is that? Yeah. But, I don't know. You know what? It's too complicated to talk right now. No, I mean, we've got about 8 minutes left.
Right.
And let's go. All right, Jack, thank you. One of the reasons I got fired from this UAW-owned station was because I said the Democrats are the other half of the ruling racket. I don't think they're that anymore. They've kind of lost that status. But
I thought you made the most money. That's why you...
All right, thanks, Jack. Let's see. Here's Jeff's down in Toledo. Jeff, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air. Did I do this right? No, I didn't. All right. Sorry. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Now, Jeff, you're on the air.
How you doing?
Doing well, thanks.
Season's greetings from Toledo.
Season's greetings.
Yes, the global warming is obviously part of this. I mean, give me a break. I can't believe people call up and ask, what do you think? What do you think? It's snowing here. But anyway.
But that's the
that
right...
That happens in April sometimes.
The right wing...
But global warming is an issue, yes.
I remember when I was a kid... in early March, riding around when I was in high school in a convertible, and there's my unnamed wife, who I hope she doesn't mind that I mention her birthday, which is in early March. There's photographs of us sitting out on our porch in short sleeve shirts.
Yeah.
So there's been other periods of of great warmth during the Middle Ages.
Fluctuation.
Yeah, there's been
say,
during the Middle Ages there were these periods of intense heat in Europe. But what we're talking about is this is all adjusted. I mean, you've got a few right wing kooks that are saying, and a few scientists that are these paid whores of the energy companies that are saying it's not. But every Scientologist, but climatologist.
We don't have time to go there.
Yeah, you know, say that this is happening. And one of the things is so that I've said repeatedly, let's say that Al Gore and every on all the scientists are all wrong, that in fact that it hasn't been human activity, and this is just climate variation that is natural. Well, the worst that we can do by following their what would you say, predictions or what they think should be done, is we'd clean up the environment, we'd get us off of fossil fuels, we would bring environmental practices in tune with what makes sense, and then we'd find out, oh, well, it turns out it wasn't global warming. If these right-wingers are wrong, we're really, really screwed.
Yeah.
If we haven't already screwed ourselves as a planetary inhabitant already. All right, thank you very much. Okay, here is here's Bob. Don't spell it backwards. Go ahead. You're on the air. Bob?
Yeah, hey, what's going on, man?
Hi.
Hey, okay, hello, people, man. Hey, no questions asked. I just want to say thanks for the entertainment, and thanks for letting the public speak their expressions, you know?
I appreciate that, Bob.
Well, that's all, man. Guys, have a good night.
All right, rock out.
Yeah, rock Bob. On, Bob.
Rock out,
thank
rock
you.
Out, whichever way. Here's Mohammed in Dearborn. Mohammed, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You are on the air. Welcome.
Hey, guys, how are you?
We're great.
Oh, well, I just want to kind of, well, yeah, when you were talking about Howard Cosell and his comment, I believe he was making it towards Art Monk for the Redskins, and he made a spectacular catch and leaped up in the air and said, look, he just jumped in the air like a little monkey.
Yeah.
And Jimmy DeGee, which is kind of unfortunate because Howard Cosell is actually one of the good guys. And I actually kind of want to beat on this dead horse of Don Imus. Now, a lot of these guys are chiming in saying, you know, well, you know, if it's okay for black people to use the N-word, how come it's not cool for us? Like, why would you want to use it? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. Do you want to use that word? Like,
it's a horrible word.
It's associated with so much hate.
Yeah.
And, you know, to actually rip on these intelligent women, you know, that played for Rutgers, you know, came out of nothing and you know, actually had a shot of going all the way and, you know, to take their moment away from them, it was horrible, and I believe he got, you know, what he deserved.
Yeah, well, by the way, Mohammed, a number of people have said, they say ho all the time, and nobody says anything. There are so many people within, so many African Americans that are so incredibly critical of that gangster rap and repeatedly are critical of it that this is another one of those many, many, many false accusations. Got to move through this a little quickly. Thanks for your call. And let's see, here is Dan in Pontiac. Dan, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter, how you doing? Always a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
Let me comment on that last one. First of all, if Don Imus went to work every day with his pants halfway down his behind and a ball cap turned to the right and wearing a gold chain on his neck with a big spinning wheel on it, you know, there wouldn't have been no controversy. That would have been his lifestyle on another lifestyle. But he didn't. He was a socially respected man, and he went into, you know, dialogue that was not fitting in his social life. So he was actually attacking another social way, if you understand where I'm going with that.
Go ahead.
You know, so as far as him getting fired, I don't think it should have been that punishable. You know, give the man another chance. Keep him his job.
First of all,
trying to fire
Don's not going to wear the bling.
But you know, Dan, again, you are
reaching.
Yeah, you're also talking on the basis of fairness. It's like a punishment in high school. Should the person be expelled permanently, or should they get suspended, or should they have to stay after school? I'm telling you, it's all a business decision. All the corporations involved, from CBS through to the sponsors, decided, is this going to work for us, or is it not going to work for us? They were all prepared to leave him in there and just say his punishment would be a 2-week suspension until the sponsors left. left. And then they said this is not something that is going to be economically viable for us, which is the only thing that they care about. I mean, I don't mean to say that none of these that none of these corporate types have no conscience, but ultimately it's trumped by money. And so, you know, I'll just say it once again. The only people responsible for this, as he said himself, I have to say he did take, in between these other little grumbles.
He even cried, I think.
Oh, he did.
Oh, I
hate
know.
When that happens. Is that, you know, that his remarks are what sparked his totally inappropriate remarks. And then it was the corporation that said, goodbye, Don.
And that would
and
be
I'm going to
plural.
Say goodbye to you right now.
Advertisers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there, I'm sorry, I got a couple people left, but I got to go because, you know, the clock on the wall says even we're a little late now. Celine Jordan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
And,
thank you, everyone.
Thank you for listening and for calling. We'll do the live show again next week, of course. And you know what? I haven't even told you this. I'm going to may embarrass you on the air, but you're going to be doing this show without me one of these coming weeks, coming up soon.
Oh, I'm ready.
You're ready. Okay.
I ate my Wheaties.
All right. And so stay tuned for the interviews. I think you'll enjoy them.
Listening to WRIF.com.
Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Pleasure to be with you, even though sometimes the subjects aren't they're not ones that make us exactly joyful. One of them was a few weeks ago when we spoke to Helen Caldicott, and she spoke about the effort to place nuclear weapons in space. It was a very, very disturbing and frightening conversation for me. And, in fact, we were talking about Dr. Strangelove, and it made me go out and get Stanley Kubrick's famous classic movie and see it again. Once you got by that humor, it was a fairly disturbing movie as well, although I would highly recommend it. Well, there are also nukes on Earth. And joining me, actually, let me welcome him back to the Peter Werby Show, is Joseph Gerson. His latest book is Empire and the Bomb. Subtitle is How the U.S. Uses Nuclear Weapons to Dominate the World. And Joseph Gerson is the director of programs of the American Friends Service Committee in New England. That's the principal Quaker peace organization in the United States. He's a leading figure in the U.S. peace movement, and his previous books include The Sun Never Sets and With Hiroshima Eyes. Joseph Gerson, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you for having me.
I suspect that people are probably going, wait, what does he mean? The U.S. uses nuclear weapons to dominate the world. The United States doesn't dominate the world. We try to be friends with everyone, and certainly we're not an empire. And why don't you explain this a little?
Well, you know, I was trained initially for the U.S. Foreign Service back in the 1960s, and, you know, there we were taught very clearly that, you know, when one studies history, one studies the rise and fall of empires. And actually, one of my professors back then was a man named Jules Davids, who was the principal ghostwriter of John Kennedy's Profiles in Courage. And as you look and study it, you see that the United States initially created a continental empire. And then beginning in the 1890s, began to move it globally. You know, the Spanish-American War was the occasion for conquering Cuba and Puerto Rico, Philippines, and Guam. And then over time, we've built it to the point where certainly in the first part of this century, we have a range of people from former National Security Advisors Zbigniew Brzezinski and Henry Kissinger to neoconservatives and liberals, all being very clear that the U.S. has long been an empire, and it rules in a variety of ways.
Well, the empire in the 20th century turned out to be a bad word, and that's what the other people have. It was the evil empire of the Soviets. But in the 19th century, and particularly in the late 19th, well, from the 1850s on, maybe to World War I at least, the American expansionists spoke quite openly about the need for an American empire.
Right. I mean, it's even if you go back, William Appleton Williams, who was one of the really principal U.S. historians, writes about how at the Constitutional Convention in the late 18th century, you know, the model that they have, and it's understandable, you know, were the British and French and Spanish empires, and before that the Greeks and Romans. So this is basically what was structured in the U.S. Constitution, and then built over, you know, a period of a couple hundred years. And, you know, we've now sort of hit a crisis with the efforts to reconsolidate it with the invasion of Iraq, and you know, we're in a kind of a global imperial crisis right now.
Well, tell us about Empire and the Bomb, and, I mean, this is quite a serious charge, I would suspect, to most Americans, that the U.S. uses nuclear weapons to dominate the world.
Well, some of this is stuff we know, and some of it is pretty well hidden. For example, on the 50th anniversary of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there was a huge struggle over what could and could not be shown at the Smithsonian Institution for that anniversary. I was part of an effort that wanted to bring forward quotations from people like former President Eisenhower, former Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Leahy, and others, who were very clear that the atomic bomb wasn't necessary to end the war with Japan. The Japanese were attempting to surrender on terms that the U.S. ultimately accepted. The reasons were that we wanted to, as Secretary of State Burns said, we wanted to bring the war to an immediate halt so we wouldn't have to share influence in Asia with the Soviet Union. And then when you look, you know, the Soviet Union really didn't begin to get anything like nuclear parity with the United States until the late 1970s. And so you see the structuring of global relations under the threat of U.S. nuclear attacks. And in fact, again, largely unknown to the U.S. people, and what I document in my book, is the more than 30 occasions when the United States prepared and threatened to initiate, and it's important to initiate nuclear war in order to maintain this global power.
Well, your word threat, again, that has quite a strong connotation to it, yet you say in Empire and the Bomb that every U.S. president has threatened nuclear war, and you think, boy, does that mean Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton and Ike Eisenhower? Tell us some of the circumstances.
Well, Eisenhower probably almost more than any other president prepared and threatened to initiate nuclear war, beginning with Korea in 1952. That war, at least the diplomatic process, was stalemated, and Eisenhower was very clear that he got the Koreans to do what he wanted by threatening attack. And in fact, more than a decade later, when President Nixon communicated what he called the November ultimatum to the Vietnamese, he was very clear that he had learned at Eisenhower's knee how to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Again, in 1954, we offered the French two nuclear weapons to break the siege at Dien Bien Phu, but the French thought, the wind might blow the wrong way. We don't want that. Threats were made during the 1956 Suez War, 1958 at the time of the Iraqi revolution and the first stages of the Lebanese Civil War. And if you go on through Kennedy and Johnson and so on. With Carter, what you have, the principal threat that he made was called the Carter Doctrine, in which he said that the United States would use, quote-unquote, any means necessary to reinforce its control of the Persian Gulf. And Clinton used it repeatedly against North Korea, against Libya, and against Iraq.
These are threats.
These are threats.
Yeah. Now, do the threats work?
Well, in some cases they have, in other cases they haven't. For example, in 1969, with Nixon's November ultimatum, he moved U.S. forces onto what's called a DEFCOM 1 alert. That's the highest level of nuclear alert. And kept U.S. forces at that level for almost 30 days, to the point where senior officers in the Pentagon were pleading with him to end the alert lest there be a major accident. But the Vietnamese didn't blink. The Vietnamese felt that they were willing to take the risks and they would survive. They'd been there a long time and they would be there into the future. On the other hand, for example, in 1973, in the close of the Middle East War, when the Israelis were violating a ceasefire and really very doing more than threatening, actually in the process of essentially killing the entire Egyptian Third Army by depriving it food and water, Sadat, the president of Egypt, called for the U.S. and the Soviet Union both to intervene to break that siege. And Kissinger had essentially been manipulating the outcome of that war so the U.S. power in the region would increase, and he didn't want the Russians coming in. So what he did, essentially in secret from the U.S. people, was again to move the U.S. forces onto a DEFCOM 1 alert. The Russians backed down. At the same time, Kissinger told Golda Meir, enough is enough, she had to honor the ceasefire. So in that case, it did work. It kept the Russians from intervening to try to save an army.
The book is Empire and the Bomb, How the U.S. Uses Nuclear Weapons to Dominate the World. My guest is Joseph Gerson on the Peter Werbe Show. It's published by Pluto Press. You can go to PlutoBooks.com and also to AFSC.org/PES.
There's also a bit of a Michigan connection here in that it's distributed in the United States by the University of Michigan Press.
Oh, that's right. You're right. I did notice that in the press release. I was I'm glad you brought that up. Now, let me try another tact on this. You mentioned all the circumstances in which the United States had nuclear hegemony and wanted to have its way, or some people would say our way, politically, militarily, in the world, and this was against bad guys. We're the good guys, the Soviets, the North Vietnamese, the Viet Cong, the Russians, the Chinese, whatever. These are all the bad guys. We're the good guys, they're the bad guys, and if we have a weapon that we can manipulate, a situation where essentially it doesn't wind up to be a military confrontation because people are so afraid of us, isn't this a positive?
Well, I think one of the questions that we have to ask, and this is the deepest and perhaps the most troubling question, is are we always the good guys? Were we the good guys when we invaded Vietnam? Were we the good guys when we overthrew the governments of Guatemala or Iran, for example? The rest of the world at this stage, and this includes many of our allies in Europe, don't view us necessarily as the good guys. And they look at a situation where, the United States led the world in negotiating the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty back in the late 1960s, one of the most fundamental deals, really, of the 20th century, in which countries like Iran agreed not to develop nuclear weapons in exchange for the nuclear powers led by the United States agreeing to negotiate their abolition. But the United States has refused to implement that. Countries like Mexico, Sweden, others have been pressing the United States to fulfill its treaty obligations. One of the things I describe in the book is having asked former director of the CIA, John Deutsch, about why the United States doesn't fulfill this part of the treaty. And his response to me was, we never intended, nor do we intend now, to implement Article 6. That's just something you have to say to get what you want out of a conference. So we have a situation where we've kind of consistently made threats against other people, prepared and threatened to initiate nuclear war, and the rest of the world is saying, enough of this. One of the people that I also quote, who I have tremendous respect for, is Joseph Rotblat, who was the one senior scientist in the initial project to develop the A-bomb, who quit when he learned it was really about Russia and not about Japan. He's been clear throughout his life that, humanity faces a fundamental choice. We can either completely abolish these weapons, or we're going to see their proliferation and their use. As he said, no nation is long going to tolerate what they perceive to be an unjust imbalance of terror, and they'll move to rectify that. And that's why, on the one hand, we're in such a dangerous situation, and on the other, why it's important for us to really be fundamentally changing our policies and our approaches.
Well, let me talk to you about the dangers, as you're talking about, Joseph Gerson, because some people would say, well, you're Chicken Little, because people in the peace movement have been saying that we're facing the threat of nuclear annihilation for the last 50 or 60 years, and in fact, it's never occurred. The United States was able to end the war in the Pacific on its terms. I think the common perception is still that it was needed militarily. I agree with you that it was simply a political act. But we've been able to keep this all under control. And as we said, it's never gotten beyond the level of threats. I mean, threatening someone in a bar is one thing. Having a bar brawl is another.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you have to look at immediate and long-term consequences. Thinking simply domestically something which is little known are the number of nuclear weapons victims here within the United States who are given essentially no attention for obvious reasons. Both white and principally Native American miners and their families, uranium miners, who have just died like flies. People living downwind from the tests, even when they've been conducted underground in places like Utah and Idaho. People in say Washington State, where out of the Hanford plant, they've had controlled releases of radiation into the Columbia River. So in some ways, we've been killing ourselves with this program, and it's been held pretty secret. At the other level is the question of proliferation. The reality is that as you say, we've not had detonation of nuclear weapons during wartime. Since Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But what we see is that the refusal to fulfill our treaty obligations and to move to rectify this gross imbalance of really genocidal terror has led other countries then to develop and obtain their own nuclear weapons. India, Pakistan, Israel, probably Iran, certainly North Korea. And this is a circumstance in which, would you feel more secure in a room without where people didn't have guns pointed at one another, or would you feel more comfortable in a room where everybody's got a gun pointed at one another? This is the world we're headed towards.
Someone's going to use it eventually. In other words, when talking about this, I often quote Napoleon saying, "The only thing you cannot do with bayonets is sit on them." That armies and weaponry are essentially meant to be used, and if the United States is
is able to maintain it, its nuclear force in a rational manner. Can everyone else? To me, always the most frightening country among any number of them, and it's a real contest these days, is Russia, with so many and political developments there and security there so insecure. Would you put them at the top of the pack or something like Pakistan?
Well, I'm afraid I would still put the United States at the top of the pack, but I wouldn't denigrate the power and dangers of the others. I mean, you should understand, people need to realize that U.S. nuclear doctrine, public nuclear doctrine, is to name seven nations as primary nuclear targets, to have a commitment to build and to use more usable nuclear weapons. We were able to defeat Cheney's effort to build another generation of bunker busters. But as we speak now, the Bush administration wants to spend $150 billion to expand the nuclear weapons production infrastructure and to develop a whole new generation of nuclear weapons. At the moment, we've just sent the largest fleet into the Persian Gulf to threaten Iran. And whether attacks against Iran would be conventional or tactical nukes, the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs are, by today's standards, tactical nukes. These are things we have to really worry about. Certainly, we should be encouraging Congress and the President to be spending more money, to be providing greater control over for the Russian government to exercise more control over its nuclear weapons. That seems to be happening. But the greater danger has to do, I think, on the one hand with unemployed scientists, and on the other, there was the AQ Khan network out of Pakistan, Khan being the thought to be the father of the Pakistani bomb, who became a bit of an entrepreneur and began selling this stuff around the world. And that's where we need to be putting quite a bit of energy.
Any political movement in this country other than popular protests, such as your organization, the American Friends Service Committee, and other anti-nuclear weapons group, is there any, the politicians always seem to be light years behind what the people want. For instance, if nothing else, on the situation in Iraq, even the Democrats seem to be way behind popular opinion. Is there any movement towards eliminating this?
Well, one of the really quite amazing things, I was traveling not long ago, and lo and behold, in the Wall Street Journal, there was an op-ed article signed by, among other people, Henry Kissinger, saying that it is of urgent importance that we move to abolish nuclear weapons, and essentially making a number of the points that I've made in this interview, that the kind of nuclear hypocrisy, the idea that we can possess and threaten the use of these things and other nations can't, isn't going to work, and really increases the insecurity of U.S. people and others. So you have, I think, in growing elite opinion, the former chief of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the former chief of the U.S. Strategic Command, General Lee Butler, who used to command all of our nuclear weapons, has been very clear in calling for the abolition of nuclear weapons. And you have different efforts, different kinds of lobbies in Washington are working to prevent funding for the expansion of the U.S. Production infrastructure, a thing called Complex 2030 that I was talking about, and the funding for the development of a new nuclear weapon. One of the other interesting things that's happening in both New Hampshire and Iowa, where we have the first primary and caucuses, and where the candidates come and do what we call retail politics, have to come into diners and shopping centers and so on. People there have been asking them questions about whether we should be threatening Iran with genocide, whether they will support vote for funding for new nuclear weapons, and this seems to be having an effect.
Well, that's heartening, because when I think of the amount, I mean, Helen Caldicott, in my interview with her a few weeks ago, was talking about the number of weapons from Russia that are still pointed and either on, I don't know if they're on full alert now or whatever the phrase is, but they can easily be done so. And wasn't there a point at which the president of Russia, Putin, offered a reduction in a joint reduction with the United States, and Bush refused it in the last few years?
Well, there was a kind of a smoke and mirrors agreement made at the beginning of the Bush administration. It was called the Moscow Treaty. It's about three pages long, and it's, you know, it's not a whole lot more valuable than toilet paper. Essentially, the Russians, with their inability to invest in maintaining their nuclear arsenal as a result of the collapse of the Soviet Union, were unable to field as many nuclear weapons as they were in the past, and needed a way to kind of, in a face-saving way, acknowledge the reduction of their arsenal. At the same time, the Bush administration was moving to maximize its nuclear dominance, and as you're referring to in your interview with Helen Caldicott, moving to dominate the militarization of space. And to do this, the United States needed to get rid of the anti-ballistic missile treaty. So they made an agreement whereby they said, well, we'll vastly reduce the size of our two arsenals by the year 2012. Of course, it's not verifiable, and it ceases to be in effect the day after the treaty expires. So it's, you know, it's just a little bit more of Bush showmanship.
Hmm. Yeah, what is it? The United States has about 10,000 intercontinental ballistic missiles, and the Soviet Union about 8,000, something like that.
That number of warheads. And when we talk about these weapons, we need to understand that we're talking about a number of these hydrogen bombs, you know, are up to, you know, 500, 1,000 times more powerful than the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, the Hiroshima bomb destroyed the city of Hiroshima in 9 seconds.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we need to understand that, you know, it's difficult, you know, when you want to go get a Starbucks coffee or, you know, or just go see a friend to think about, you know, the kind of genocidal power that is arrayed around the world.
Well, it would seem that if countries wanted to either have a hedge against invasion or a threat or whatever, you could do that with like 500 of them. I mean, why do these? Why is this madness such that then these nations like the United States and Russia feel that there has to maintain this level of weapons?
Well, there's a number of forces involved. One of which, you know, President Eisenhower warned about as he was leaving the presidency, when he warned about the subversive, that's his language, the subversive nature of the military-industrial complex, that, you know, there's money to be made here, and corporations will be lobbying to make more money. The same with the weapons labs. They want to expand both their income, their money, and their power. You've got, you know, generals who want to be able to hit the same bridge with 5 or 10 different nuclear weapons just to make sure they get the bridge. So you have a whole lot of forces at play there. And it's also important to go back and to, again, if you're totally bored one night, you can go up on the Pentagon's webpage and, you know, find, you know, what the declared policy is. What you find is that the U.S., you have a policy which the Pentagon says is not deterrence and never has been. Generals have gone and testified before Congress that our policy is not deterrence. And when they fall into the language of deterrence, what they say is that it's to prevent an action by another country, a course of action, COA they call it, which is not necessarily preventing a nuclear attack, but simply doing something that's inimical to what are defined as U.S. interests. For example, perhaps raising the price of oil, and for this we threaten nuclear attack.
What's our, and this is a hard one, I'm sure for you, what's our chances? I know the Positions for Social Responsibility, the group that Helen Caldicott founded, has this, or is it them that has the doomsday clock?
And the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists.
Oh, yeah, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, right. And they I think they have it up to about 7 minutes before midnight.
They moved it, actually, within the last year, they moved it up to 5 minutes before midnight.
Yeah.
I mean, the situation is really quite dangerous, and we're in a situation where, you know, with the Iraq War, as people in Washington say, you know, the Iraq War has sucked almost all the political oxygen out of Congress and really in our public discourse. So what that's meant is that only on the margins have we been able to talk about or explore, name, struggle against these dangers.
Here's what Daniel Ellsberg, the former Pentagon and State Department official who released the Pentagon Papers, says about Joseph Gerson's book, Empire and the Bomb. Brilliant, he says. I've not read a more important book in many years. Gerson has uncovered the radioactive vein in our secret foreign policy. He helps us understand why the likelihood of nuclear war is greater now than before the fall of the Berlin Wall. It's information, not very cheery, but information good to have if you're going to move in this world to make it safer. Joseph Gerson has been my guest. You can go to the website of the American Friends Service Committee. It's afc.org/PES. I'll have that on my website, peterwerby.com. Joseph Gerson, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Right, are we ready?
Yeah!
The $40,000 Riff Rock Girl search is on. 101 WRIF and Bud Light are looking for one woman to represent the Riff for 1 year. And it's up to you to decide. Go to WRIF.com now and vote for your favorites to advance to the Sexy 16. Only you will decide who will be the next WRIF Rock Girl.
You ready for some hot, steamy fun?
Starring in a WRIF Billboard Cafe, an Added Stuff magazine, and representing the Riff at concerts and events.
She looks hot.
More details at WRIF.com. The 2007 Riff Rock Girl Search. Brought to you by Bud Light. Always worth it. MGM Grand Detroit, where the city shines. At 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
It's time to live the mortgage expert. 800-333-ROCK.
Hey, WRIF listeners, I'm David Hall from Rock Financial, and you've heard me talk about our exclusive programs, but did you know that you can check them out for yourself? Visit us online at rockfinancial.com. You'll find a ton of useful information and tools, and you can learn about our programs, get the latest on interest rates, even contact or look up your mortgage expert. It's amazing. Rockfinancial.com gives you answers to all your mortgage questions with just a couple of clicks. Learn more about purchasing a new home or refinancing your current home. You can even figure out your monthly payment with our cool mortgage calculator. You got to find out more. Call the mortgage experts today or visit us online. Go to rockfinancial.com.
It's time to live. Yeah. 800-333-ROCK. Your mortgage experts. 800-333-ROCK.
A Quicken Loans Company. Equal housing lender.
I love you guys.
You're the best, sugar.
When can you turn me on, dear?
Right now, Cavalier is turning people on all over America.
Yeah, baby.
Because we're offering unbelievably attractive deals on telephone and internet service.
I'm all yours, darling.
If you sign up today, we'll give you unlimited phone calls with voicemail, call waiting, caller ID.
You're gorgeous, beautiful, amazing.
All for the seductive price of $24.95 a month.
You got me, honey.
We'll also give you the hottest, fastest DSL internet service with free modem, free email addresses, and personal web page.
You got it going on, girl.
For a stunning $14.95 a month.
You are all that.
So if you want to start a beautiful relationship, call 866-218-7272 and let Cavalier turn you on today.
Gucci, Gucci, cool.
Availability varies by region. Prices exclude taxes and surcharges.
When should you call defense attorney John McWilliams?
When the police leave a card in your door saying they want to talk to you. When the police put the word out that they have a warrant out for your arrest. If you or a loved one is asked to take a lie detector test. When the police take you, a family member, or a relative to the station for questioning. Or if you've been read your rights. Or the police want to question you without reading you your rights. That's when.
Immediately call defense attorney John McWilliams at 313-581-4445. Defense attorney John McWilliams wants you to know that if you're a suspect or somehow involved in the investigation of a criminal offense, you need representation right away. Even if
the police say you aren't under arrest and they just want to talk, or if they ask you for your side of the story, or to clear up some things so they can close the case, you need to have defense attorney John McWilliams present.
Be smart. When the police ask you to cooperate, you may be cooperating yourself into prison. Call defense attorney John McWilliams, 313-581-4445. That's 313-581-4445.
Guys, if you're looking for the ultimate gentleman's club experience, the only place to be is Cheetahs of Windsor. Monday at Cheetahs of Windsor, get free admission with your U.S. ID, and Tuesdays, get $10 dances all day and all night. Wednesday, enjoy a complimentary Italian buffet after midnight. Thursday is Riff Rock and Roll Night, and catch the Wild Girly Show on Friday. Cheetahs of Windsor is your ultimate bachelor party headquarters. Bring your party on Friday or Saturday, and Cheetahs of Windsor will put the bachelor on stage for the time of his life. Cheetahs of Windsor puts their money where their mouth is. They guarantee you the best-looking girls from all around the world, or they'll buy you your beer. It's time to head to the party at Cheetahs of Windsor and let your dreams run wild. Cheetahs of Windsor, just minutes from the Bridger Tunnel at 86 Chatham Street West. Call today for groups of 10 or more and receive a complimentary limo, 313-963-6148, or log on to cheetahsofwindsor.com.
We're looking out there.
The pictures, the podcast, the blog,
the special features you just don't get
anywhere else.
Super f***ing cool.
Get them online at WRIF.com.
I shall lose yourself.
Or check us out at myspace.com/WRIF.
Guaranteed to be extreme.
Because we can always use more friends, and we won't be naked.
Does anyone else smell Astroglide?
101.
WRIF.
People are sexy and clever, and they always say something funny right before a commercial break.
Everything that rocks. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Pleasure to be with you. Well, this program, anyway, is about analyzing the news. And information is so important to how we come to a conclusion about what's happening in the world. We are inundated with information. This is called the age of information. I often ask people, do you think people are smarter today than they were, say, 20 years ago? But there certainly is an avalanche of information, particularly with the advent of the Internet. But are we getting all the news? Well, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the broadcast someone who we've caught up with any number of times with their yearly book about censored news stories. This edition is called Censored 2007, the Top 25 Censored Stories, and it's the 30th anniversary edition. Joining me is Peter Phillips, and he's the director of Project Censored. He's an associate professor of sociology at Sonoma State University in California. He's known for his op-ed pieces in the alternative press and independent newspapers nationwide, such as Z Magazine, Social Policy, and others. And although we're going to be talking about how the mainstream media, increasingly being called the MSM, dominates still information, but there are some good alternatives out there. Joining us from California is Peter Phillips. Welcome back to the broadcast.
Well, Peter, thanks for having me on again. It's great to be back on with you.
Well, you know what would really be a real pleasure, and it hasn't happened yet, if I called you and I said, hey, Peter Phillips, what happened to your book Censored 2008 or 2009? And you said, you know, there weren't any censored this year. Everything that people needed to know was out there, but it ain't happened yet, has it?
No, not at all. In fact, it's gotten even worse as we look at it. Media's so consolidated now. We've got less than 10 major media corporations. And unfortunately, that's where like 85% of the people in the country get almost all their news.
Even beyond the Internet, huh?
The Internet is out there, but the biggest sites used on the Internet for news are MSNBC and Fox and CNN.
Wow.
And, you know, so but people, they can get emails, they get news, there's other sources. In fact, there's we monitor 800 websites looking for news stories from all over the world, and then we pick the ones that are the most important for coverage in our book each year and post the other ones up on a monthly basis on our website. But it's quite obvious to us now that corporate media, top-down media, is really functioning on kind of what they want us to know, a top-down perspective on how they see the world. And it resembles propaganda in many cases, particularly stories that emerge from government public relation firms and that.
Well, the book and your efforts get more incredible with each passing year. Censored 2007, the Top 25 Censored Stories. Peter Phillips and Project Censored has an introduction by a guest, in fact, almost a frequent guest on this program, Robert Jensen, a professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. Cartoons in it by Tom Tamaro, who has joined us as well, and this is published by Seven Stories Press. You can always go to projectcensored.org, which is updated frequently. But how are the choices made for the top 25? I mean, you could probably do 250, eh?
Well, right now we're voting. We narrowed it down from 200 about 2 weeks ago down to 55. And then all of the faculty and students here at Sonoma State, some 200 of us, will vote on those next week. So this is a list that will come out officially in September. And so we've narrowed those stories down from, we get 200 publications, thousands of news stories. We've spent over a year on it. Students in two classes work almost exclusively finding, researching these stories. So it's a lengthy process. And then we have over 110 evaluators, faculty evaluators. So if the story's on nuclear energy, then a physicist will look at it.
Now, let's talk about language a little. The subtitle of your book, Censored 2007, is the top 25 censored stories, which precisely it means that they were eliminated. Yet in your press release, it says underreported. Now, these have had some, they've seen the light of day, right? Or we wouldn't know about them.
Well, they came from independent news sources. And were not aired in the corporate media, or if they were, they were aired very briefly, and usually aired means not, I mean, not television. They might have been in some limited coverage in some newspapers, like one time, and there's some really deliberate examples of that. But most of these have not had any coverage in the corporate media in the United States.
Well, a listener might be thinking, well, who's Peter Phillips and all those people at Sonoma State College to say what's important to select out of the thousands of stories? I've edited journals and papers before, and you got to make a selection. So why, I mean, you're saying, you know, who are you to be the editor, essentially, would be the question.
Well, I'm one of 200 people that vote, and we're, you know, faculty, PhDs, and students collectively making subjective judgments about which stories are the most important. So we'll narrow that down to the 25 for this year next week, and then those go out to the national judges who rank them, and they'll say this is number one, this is number two. So Robin Anderson, who's the chair of the Department of Communications at Fordham University, or Dennis Luz, a professor down at Cal State Pomona, Bob Hackett up at Simon Fraser in Canada, and 25 other national scholars, they're the ones that rank the stories.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we end up with number one, two, three, and four.
Well, maybe I wasn't clear enough, but what I meant was that each editor of a newspaper or of a television station or any news source has to make a choice. So they've made choices that you and the other people that have selected these don't agree with. I'm saying why should these be seen as important as opposed to the ones they did select? In other words, they would probably say, well, gee, we underselected them because we didn't think they were that important.
Well, I guess you'd have to look at what corporate media is doing today. They're essentially in the entertainment business. So we look at the Anna Nicole Smith story and all of the coverage that's gone on relative to her baby and her various relationships and then her death and all of this extensive, it's entertainment news. It's gossip news. You know, it's like a soap opera. And there's an opportunity cost when you have stories like that. So whether it's Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie or any other kind of entertainment stories, that's what the corporate media is doing. They're filling up the airways with entertainment news or high emotional kinds of content, really kind of addicting people to watching in many ways, and or scaring us with terrible stories or fears of terrorists or fears of diseases or whatever. And then they leave out very important stories about what the powerful people in this country or in the world are doing, the decisions they're making that impact our lives, and we don't hear about it.
Peter Phillips is my guest. He's one of the editors of Censored 2007, the top censored stories of that year. Well, actually, of last year, right?
From March of last year, right.
Yeah, to 2005 and 2006. Tell us, maybe we could get at it this way, because as I think you know, I was being the devil's advocate. Many of my listeners think I am in any event. But to get a sense of what is left out, maybe we ought to look directly at the stories themselves. Number one, it sounds like David Letterman, doesn't it? Except they start with number 10. Number one, this is one that I suspect many people probably have not even heard of, and on the face of it, they might think, oh, I don't know, what big deal, why does that affect me? But tell us about number one.
Well, this is how the internet providers in the country are being consolidated into AT&T and Comcast through the cable offerings, and that how Congress has been reluctant to implement any laws that guarantee internet neutrality, meaning that all websites will have full access, that people will have full access to all websites. And there's no laws that prevent Internet providers from actually excluding websites. They could, in fact, make it literally impossible to get to projectcensored.org or any other website that was not deemed politically correct. And the whole Internet neutrality debate is about how Congress is allowing AT&T and Comcast, they spent lots of money to make this happen, not to provide direct access from other Internet providers and to dominate the market. And they were even offering tiered levels of service so that you can buy high speed, medium speed, low speed, and certain levels of access to various parts of the Internet, but not the whole thing. And that has people concerned. We have a World Wide Web to which we would like to have full access to websites all over the world for news and information, and we don't want that being censored in any way.
All right, let's actually, we could almost make a show based on each one of these top censored stories.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, and number two, of course, are our friends Halliburton, making money again, charged with selling nuclear technologies to Iran. Tell us about that one.
An amazing story. Jason Leopold published this in Global Reach. He writes for Truth Out as well. And he's interviewed Halliburton employees. And they informed him that there's a subsidiary of Halliburton called Halliburton Tools that's incorporated in the Cayman Islands. And this subsidiary actually has an office in Tehran and has been selling nuclear technologies to Iran for 10 years. They've sold them centrifuges and other technologies necessary for nuclear production. So this was in violation of laws, executive orders that Clinton had signed in 96 saying to be no trading with Iran or expansion there. But since this is a subsidiary and it's incorporated outside the United States, laws didn't apply. Of course, Cheney was chief executive then.
Mm-hmm.
And then goes on to be vice president and is one of the major saber rattlers around how we have to go bomb Iran today.
Now, I would think in that there's been since the 2006 elections a change of more criticality on the part of the mainstream media. Peter Phillips, you tell me in answering if you don't think that's entirely true, but that Bush and Cheney are not getting the free ride that they did in the previous 5 years, that you would think that this would act as an incredible tip to somebody in the mainstream media to say, man, this is a hell of a story. I'm going to put this on the front page.
It's not there.
Well,
it hasn't been there. We've checked it out. It's gone nowhere. And, of course, millions of people around the world have seen it because the project censored. And it's been translated in every European language. Our books came out in Italian, Spanish, and Arabic this year. But so people all over the world know this story, but in the U.S., it certainly hasn't been in the corporate media.
Well, as I often say to when I interview people from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, let me put it another way, because it's in a way the same story. When I give talks on the media, I say, how many people think the media is doing its job? And, of course, nobody in the audience raises their hand. And I say, I think they're doing their job perfectly, that the corporate media, it does exactly how you does what you defined it earlier in our discussion. It's not about trying to give citizens full information so we can participate in the democratic institutions of this country. It's there to make a profit and also to protect the institutions that ultimately give them their profits.
Protect the institutions and sell product.
Sure.
That's what it's about.
So,
the First Amendment in the Constitution was established to keep the American electorate informed. I mean, that was what it was about, so that press could be active, they could, there'd be no interference by the government in press. But what we've got de facto is a corporate media, a press that is agenda is the bottom line, the agenda is entertainment, and the agenda is closely linked to corporate and government public relation firms for news content. It's easier if they use literally VNRs, video news releases, provided by PR firms for government and corporation, then they'll go out and create their own news. It's cheaper.
Mm-hmm. Well, isn't I guess there might be, I usually don't use these arguments, say, a market argument here, that if people feel more comfortable, say, going to a Fox News website than they do to truthout.org, which I certainly would suggest that they'd go to, that's the invisible hand of the market, and essentially the Peter Werbys and the Peter Phillips and the kind of ideas that we hold just aren't making the grade, you know, that people have they're out there. I mean, all of the progressive projects and the ideas for renewal of our country, the renewal of the planet and all that, it is there. It's just that it doesn't get the kind of attention that we'd like.
Well, there's really an interference with people's ability to find out about, you know, these issues, whether it's global warming or all the concerns in Iraq or, you know, how that happened or various other issues, because when corporate media covers a story, even if they cover the topic, you don't get a context. You don't get a historical understanding. You don't get a full analysis of what the issues are. It becomes sort of like an event, and then they cover it and say, oh, this happened, so many people die today, and then they go on. And so you're left without a context. You're left without an understanding of what's happening. And then you're into the entertainment stuff, which will interfere. So this idea that, you know, we're just giving the public what they want, well, we have laws and regulations about other things in that regard. I mean, you can't set up a cocaine shop in the middle of your university downtown, even though the public may very much like that. Or there would certainly be people that would want to come and buy. We have regulations and rules relative to what's best, you know, and what we think is good for society. And if corporate media is not going to do that, then we need to fund independent media. We need to fund, like the British do and most European countries, public and national radio investigative reporting that tells us what the powerful are doing.
That's interesting because here in Detroit and also in a number of other cities, the national public radio stations are starting to air the BBC, which is, you would think, boy, this is strange. We're getting our news from London. But quite a few people feel much more comfortable with that. Peter Phillips is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. He and Project Censored have censored 2007, the top 25 censored stories available now. It's a 30th anniversary edition. That's how long this has been going on. You go to projectcensored.org. I also will have a link to that on my website, peterwerbe.com. You said when I mentioned about the Halliburton subsidiary supplying Iran with nuclear technologies, that you, and I said, how come no one ever used this in the mainstream media as a lead? You said, well, as far as you know, that they hadn't. Well, you have a chapter, you and several others, called Censored Deja Vu. What happened to previous censored stories? Have any of them ever made it onto the first tier, which is...
Oh, definitely, yeah. One-third of the stories that over our 30 years of putting news stories out, over a third of them have gone on to get national media coverage, meaning that they were valid stories and they went on and they got extensive coverage. But a lot of times we don't know the reason why a particular story doesn't air. Sometimes we know very, very well that stories were available to all that. Sometimes they're not available. I mean, I don't know that the New York Times reads, the editors there read Global Reach, Global Research, which is actually out of Canada, and it's a website with a lot of international news that Michelle Jaskodowski puts together. But there's no excuse when a story goes out from Associated Press to every newspaper in the country, then they don't run it. And that case was our story number 7 this year, which was how the ACLU had acquired autopsy reports on 44 civilians who died while in U.S. custody in Afghanistan and Iraq in 2002, 3, and 4.
Suggesting they were tortured to death.
They were tortured to death. 21 of them, the cause of death listed by U.S. doctors who did the autopsies was homicide, and the other 23 listed the primary cause of death as heart failure. The conditions of the bodies indicated these people had literally had been tortured extensively.
Now, here is where an editor steps in, and I, having worked in newspapers, know this process. An editor sees this across his or her desk, and has to decide, am I going to put this in the paper or not? And
which is amazing, because AP did send this story out. It went to all 1,700 dailies in the U.S. It went to all 5,000 radio and television news programs. And less than a dozen actually ran the story.
Yeah.
So here's a deliberate decision-making process at the editorial desk level that our people don't want to hear this, or this story's too contradictory to what Americans really believe, or I don't know whatever reasons, but, you know, here was absolute proof. It goes out on some newspapers. The largest was the L.A. Times, page A4. That's never mentioned again. AP never mentions it again. All the stories about torture over the past year or two have not mentioned this documentation of a widespread. This wasn't just one base. This wasn't Abu Ghraib. This was multiple prison sites in Afghanistan and Iraq during that time period.
Well, I spent a good deal of time looking at alternative sites, so many of these, and I stress many, not all, of these items that I'd seen before, and I always think, geez, how come I don't see this anywhere else? I think this is just such a blockbuster story that if I was the editor of a paper, I'd be slapping it on page one.
Page one, absolutely.
With big headlines, like number 24. I mean, you have the list there?
Hell yeah.
Yeah. Well, number 24, that we could do all Halliburton all the time. We could have the top censored 25 Halliburton stories.
Well, Halliburton was in the news.
Yeah.
At least this was in Raw Story, and how their Cheney's Halliburton stock options rose 3,200% in 2005. And, so that was like a $7.5 million increase. So he has these options. He's still getting money from Halliburton, $250,000 a year for his, quote, retirement benefits. And so what this tells us is not only Halliburton, but all the big defense companies had massive increases in their stock values. Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, 300-400% increase in their stock value since the 9/11 wars began. So some people are making a lot of money off these wars.
In 14, the ghost of Halliburton haunts us again through KBR, right?
Yeah, Kellogg, Brown, and Root.
Yeah.
They got this big contract last year, $385 million, to build detention centers throughout the United States. And these were part of what was the Customs Enforcement, Immigration Customs Enforcement, ICE, wanted these centers because they knew they were going to be doing a real mass arrests and running down of immigrants. There's now 21,000 being held in detention centers around the country, mass arrests occurring, neighborhood attacks, families being broken up, and Halliburton's building the detention centers for these.
Yeah. You know what else they're going to put in there, Peter? People that put out books like Censored 2007.
Well, we hope we can sound off enough that enough people will realize this is the direction that this country is going.
Well, yeah.
One of the stories this year is about Operation Falcon, which is federal police and federal agencies in cooperation with local police. They're doing mass arrests of what they call felons, 10,000 simultaneously, using 900 agencies. The last time they did this was in November. They had done it twice a year before. All we can envision is, if there's a felony warrant for somebody, the local cops are supposed to go arrest them. This is practice for mass arrests. And so you could put any list. So you put in felons, you can put in immigrant communities, you can put in extreme leftists, whatever you wanted, once you've coordinated the mass arrest procedures.
Let's do this, and this is my fault. We only have about 2 minutes left, but it's not all dark and dreary. There is an alternative media, isn't there?
Very much so.
Tell us.
Some wonderful alternative media. And the Project Censored website links to some 800 independent news sources all over the world. Some really good ones. Indymedia.org is one where local activists are posting stories in 160 cities all over the country, all over the world. There are opportunities. There are ways of finding stuff. The Internet gives us that access, which is so important to keep the Internet open and free. And then there's independent news sources in every city to varying degrees that people can support and be involved with working for.
Yeah, I mean, even some of the weeklies, certainly here in Detroit, the Metro Times, I mean, I would pick that up before I would either the dailies. Also, in Detroit in June, the middle of June, there is going to be a conference called the Alternative Media Conference 2007. It's been going on, I think, for about 6-7 years. And so Detroit, our hometown.
Detroit's been good about that.
Yeah.
I mean, and a lot of cities are. There's really an effort. But so many news stories fall by the wayside, and we need a vibrant, independent media to keep us going, to keep us informed of what's happening. I mean, there's a national movement right now for impeachment, and you wouldn't know it by looking at the papers.
Yeah.
You know, 50% of the people in country support impeachment of the president, and two-thirds are opposed to the war. And there's all kinds of activities going on, but they're certainly not in the corporate media.
Yeah, quickly, and also here I grabbed your other book, Impeach the President, The Case Against Bush and Cheney, edited by Dennis Liu and Peter Phillips. That's available from 7storiespress.com as well. I don't mean to censor you, but we're about got about 10 seconds left.
It's an impressive book. We worked hard on it, 22 scholars. Impeach the President is you can find it in any bookstore, but it helps educate people out there. The degree to which this criminal regime that's in power today in the United States is violating every basic value. This is nonpartisan. I grew up as a Catholic Republican. I didn't grow up supporting torture. I didn't grow up supporting invading countries and they hadn't done anything to us. And so we really need to make a stand, and we can't allow this to continue for two more years.
Both these books are published by Seven Stories Press. You go to 7stories.com. We'll hear a couple more websites for you. ProjectCensored.org. That's where you can find out more about Censored 2007, the top 25 Censored Stories, 30th Anniversary Edition. By Peter Phillips and the Project Censored group. And, oh, yeah, the Alternative Media Conference in Detroit. You can go to amc2007.org, amc2007.org. Peter Phillips, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, Peter, for having me on.
Weekday night at 10 with Meltdown. It's like getting hit in the head by a 2x4 with a nail in it. Mandatory Metallica. Now, it's your triple play of the mighty Metallica with a big unit every Weekday night at 10, exclusively from your one and only Metallica station. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
In the time of chimpanzees, I was a monkey. Butane in my veins and mouth to get the chunky with the plastic eye. Spray paint the vegetables, dog food skulls with the beefcake pantyhose. Kill the headlights and put it in neutral. Stock car flaming with the loser and the cruise control. Babies in Reno with the vitamin D. Got a couple of couches, sleep on the love seat. Someone came singing on the scene to complain about a shotgun wedding and a stain on my shirt. Don't believe everything that you breathe. You get a foggy violation and a maggot on your sleeve. So shave your face with some mace in the dark. Because one's got a weasel and other's got a flag. One's on the pole, shove the other in a bag. With the rerun shows and the cocaine noja. The daytime crap of the folk singer squad. He hung himself with a guitar string. A slab of turkey neck and it's hanging from a pigeon wing. But get right if you can't relate. Trade the cash for the beef, for the body, for the hate. And my time is a piece of wax falling on a termite. Who's choking on the splinters. Yo, friend.
www.rockfm.com. WRIF Detroit. My name is Alan Beck stepping in. You can call me Slayer. I am here following Julian Jordan and Peter Werby with the Night Call here on the Riff. I'm here until Drew and Mike take over at 5:30 with Mark and Mike. And then the boys moving in at 6. We got lots of cool stuff coming up tonight, including the newest one from Linkin Park. Love some